Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And this is our first interim committee meeting for 2013. I want to welcome our members back, and then we have some guest members that are going to be sitting in for different portions of today's informational hearing. But before we get started on our informational meeting, we do need to do some organizational business. So do we need to have a work session for that?
Mm-hmm.
So I will go ahead and open up a work session for the purpose of adoption of committee rules, and I will look for a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 16th, 2013.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Senator Olson has moved to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 16, 2013. Is there any discussion? And assuming everybody has looked at those committee rules. Okay, no discussion. There is a motion on the table, so clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates.
Excused.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Excused.
I have no excuse. Yes.
Aye. With that, the motion carries and the rules are adopted. So we'll go ahead and close the work session, and we will open up the informational meeting portion of today's hearing. And as you can see, we have a pretty full agenda. You could say that water, energy, and fire are sort of our themes for today's hearing. And I've asked the governor's office to come and provide an update on the Klamath water situation. We know that there's been a lot happening down there, and we're fortunate to have Richard Whitman, who I believe has been spending a big portion of his summer down in Klamath Basin, along with the director of the Water Resources Department, Phil Ward. So thank you, gentlemen, and appreciate you coming here and providing an update for us.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resources Advisor. I'm going to kick this off, and then after I talk about where the Klamath Basin Task Force process is at, I'm going to ask Director Ward to talk about the specifics of the hydrologic year and what's happened in terms of regulation. But first, let me talk about the Klamath Basin Task Force. I think most of you probably know that following a hearing on Klamath water issues back in Congress, where Senator Wyden heard from a range of interest in the Klamath Basin, the Oregon congressional delegation and Governor Kitzhaber convened a task force to work on some of the remaining issues in the Klamath Basin that need to be resolved in order to move forward with a program to put that area on a more stable footing in terms of its economic future and water use in that part of the state. So that task force was convened in late June, early July, and the main task force has been meeting approximately every month. The main work of the task force really has been done by three subgroups. One subgroup dealing with water management and water management issues in the upper part of the Klamath Basin above Upper Klamath Lake. A power subgroup dealing with how to obtain, deliver low-cost power both to on-project irrigators in the Klamath Irrigation Project and off-project irrigators who participate in a water program. And then finally, and in some ways most challenging, Senator Wyden challenged the interest to make a significant reduction in the cost of the federal treasury of the actions needed to put the Klamath Basin on a stable footing. So there is a meeting of the full Klamath Basin Task Force this Thursday in Klamath Falls. We are in the final stages of preparing some materials to send out to the task force that will have fairly detailed recommendations on both the power piece and also on the issue of reducing cost to the federal treasury. And so we're at the point where we are going to be asking task force members to actually give us a head nod, leaving some additional time for them to comment on some of the details before we finalize that portion of the report. So Without getting into details, what that represents is that I think the task force has made very good progress on both the power issues and the cost reduction issues. That's not to say that those issues are completely resolved. On the power issue, for instance, there still are significant negotiations and challenges that need to be completed to actually provide that lower cost power at the end of the day. And that work will be going on over the course of the next 3, 4, or 5 months. What this work allows, though, is for the congressional delegation to begin work on actually putting together a legislative draft for Congress on how to move things forward in the Klamath. And I want to thank in particular Senator Wyden, who's been very engaged on Klamath issues, personally engaged, as well as very active engagement from Senator Merkley and Congressman Walden. All three have been very active in giving us input on the task force. The cost reduction piece also will have a fair amount of detail in it. And as I say, we have been successful in identifying both some alternate sources of funding, some ways of reducing cost, some ways of counting costs that have actually already been incurred for work in the Klamath Basin, which in combination bring the ask, if you will, of Congress down significantly in terms of a new authorization. On the water piece, there has been a subgroup on an off-project upper basin water settlement that has broad representation from ranchers and irrigators, as well as the Klamath tribes, federal agencies, the state, on the water group, and they have been meeting weekly. We are making significant progress in those negotiations. I don't have a big announcement to make today. I wish I did, but we are hard at work and continuing to make forward progress on those negotiations also. And to the point where I'm not sure how much we're going to be able to say on Thursday at the task force meeting and whether we'll be able to say something more substantive or not. But I will comment that the ranching community and the Klamath tribes have come to those negotiations very committed, very committed to the need to settle these issues. And as you're going to hear from Director Ward, there's been a lot of hardship in the basin this summer, and with both difficult economic circumstances for ranchers, farmers in the upper basin, also a lot of stress for members of the Klamath tribe as well. And so everybody's motivated to try to avoid a repeat, and I think we're making solid progress on that. So with that, that's basically my update on where we're at on Klamath. I'd be happy to answer any questions that folks might have.
Well, Director Ward, did you want to talk about the water piece, and then we'll open up for questions, if you could.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. Just a couple things relative to how the irrigation season has functioned down there in the Klamath Basin this summer. I don't need to tell anybody at this table that this has been a really challenging water year in the Klamath Basin. Early stream flows in the basin were 30 to 50% of normal. And as you know, the governor declared a drought on April 18th of this year. And so we've had those drought authorities to be able to function under there in the basin. But it has been an extremely difficult time. This, the natural drought situation was also compounded in terms of effect with the fact that we completed that the Klamath adjudication administrative phase was completed this past spring and filed with the circuit court. And what that phase did, it established the priority date for the most senior water rights there in the basin. And as a result of that phase of the adjudication being finished and that order being filed, then the department is charged with enforcing the results of that adjudication on the ground in the basin. So the senior, just to kind of give you a snapshot of where we ended in terms of the holders of the senior rights in the basin, generally three kind of categories. The Klamath tribe was granted in-stream rights for both the tributaries above the lake and the level of the lake itself with the priority date of time immemorial. There were Alati and Walton irrigation rights granted at the date of the tribal reservation of 1864. So an Alati water right is a right held by a member of the Klamath tribe on historic reservation ground. A Walton right is a water right held by someone who holds what was once a water right on the tribal reservation. So those, and then the kind of third category, large category of senior rights are the Klamath Irrigation Project rights, and those were granted with a priority date of 1905. So we received multiple calls for regulation in the Klamath Basin on June 10th. Now what that means is a number of senior water right holders contacted the department and said, we want you to deliver the water in our water rights based on our senior priority date. So we began to do that then in mid-June. The first thing you have to do when you receive a call is validate the call. That means measuring at different points to determine whether the water's really not in the system to the senior user. So we did that validation. And then we actually began regulating junior rights above Upper Klamath Lake on June 12th. The result, again, the combination of the drought situation is that the vast majority of out-of-stream rights above Upper Klamath Lake were regulated off during that month of June. Again, this was a combination of the severity of the drought and the senior water rights that we were called to enforce. A couple exceptions. One is portions of the Wood River Basin where regulation had only gone back to 1905, and that was a combination, again, of water in the system and what the senior rights were. The Klamath Irrigation Project, which you'll remember from 2001, experienced that major shutoff as a result of the Endangered Species Act, did not experience state regulation because they had come to a settlement with some of the senior water right holders as a part of the adjudication process, and so their rights to lake usage were not called in the same way that these other rights were called. They have had some reduction in water use due to federal endangered species requirements. The thing, I think a critical thing I would note here is that even in this, what has been an extremely difficult time for the regulated community up there, we have had really good, solid, good faith cooperation from the vast majority of water right holders up there. So you can imagine folks that have never had to experience regulation from a water master ever in their history on an operation, getting visited by a water master for the first time and being told that their water use was being shut off. You can imagine how challenging it is for that group of people. And I think our staff would tell you that they had some very difficult conversations, but that for the most part they were civil. And that in the vast majority of instances, folks have complied with the water master's orders in good faith. So, Madam Chair, with that, I would conclude my prepared remarks and be happy to respond to any questions.
I'm glad to hear you didn't have to call out the old water master, Smith & Wesson. So
we did not. We did not.
We'll see if there's any questions from our committee members first, and then we have a few guests that might have questions. Senator Olson.
It was interesting when you talked about the Klamath River adjudication. And it was authorized and limited by the United States Ninth Circuit Court in the Adair decision. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
The federal court confirmed that that Oregon has authority to adjudicate tribal and federal reserved water rights so long as the adjudication process is judicial in nature. The court confirmed that the Klamath tribes retain their water rights when they sell their reservation to the U.S. government, and they also said that their water right is time immemorial, as you said. However, the Ninth Circuit succinctly stated that the amount of water that the tribes were to be allocated in this adjudication was limited to the amount of water the tribes were using for a moderate living standard at the time of the Adair decision. Is that correct?
Senator, I think you're speaking pretty clearly from the court decision. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Further, the court directed that the amount of water allocated to the tribes must not create a wilderness servitude. Finally, the court specifically vacated the Panner decision that directed the department to allocate most of the water in the upper Klamath River Basin to the tribes. So my question is, how does the department's final determination comport with the directions of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals when that adjudication determination gave virtually all of the surface water tributary to upper Klamath Lakes to the tribes?
So, Madam Chair, Senator, and so because some of this is being litigated actively, certainly I need to be judicious in terms of how I answer that question. But the short answer is that the states that the legal counsel advising, both the adjudicator and the administrative law judge, that made the ultimate decisions relative to the adjudication, believe that the course they set forward in terms of the quantification of rights, what was granted under the adjudication, fully comported with the Ninth Circuit Court case. So beyond that, we could parse the semantics all day, but the legal counsel advising the adjudicator believes that the results of that adjudication comport with the Ninth Circuit case.
Okay. Do you have a follow-up? Not this time. Okay. Senator Hansel?
Has the department established the minimum lake level at any determination as to what that water right on the Klamath Lake is?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. Lake levels were part of the tribal rights that were granted. So I don't recall what the number is today, but there was a lake level right granted for the Klamath tribes. Yes, sir.
Follow up. It sustainable? How did they establish that? I've been told that it's not sustainable without dam usage, such as on Link River, and that the traditional levels that had been in place due to the volcanic reef level setting are surpassed and it's unsustainable and it can't be met. Would that be true?
So again, Madam Chair, Senator, certainly I think the adjudicator's decision was based on both scientific and historic recommendations that took a number of the factors that you just articulated into account. So I think the state's position is certainly that is a supportable water right in terms of what was granted there for the lake levels.
Follow up. The adjudicator that you're following the recommendation of, is that who is the adjudicator?
So there's basically two principles in this process. There's the administrative hearings judge, which heard all these issues and arrived at a preliminary decision, and that is an independent hearings officer that functions outside of the auspices of the department. The adjudicator is actually a department employee, but it is firewalled off as a part of the process from the administration of the agency in terms of these particular decisions. So the adjudicator was able to function as an independent entity in terms of establishing his final decisions. He did not follow all the preliminary decisions of the administrative law judge. One prime example is that the administrative law judge granted the Klamath tribe rights on the Klamath River below Upper Klamath Lake. These were lands that were not part of the original reservation, and the adjudicator overturned that piece of the administrative law judge's decision. There are some other smaller examples, but essentially that was the process. An administrative law judge, which over a 38-year period worked through, and that wasn't the total time frame that the law judge was involved, much less for the law judge, but over a period of years, worked through the claims, made preliminary decisions. Those were ultimately ratified or denied. by the adjudicator himself.
Any other questions, Senator Whitson?
Thank you very much. It'd be interesting to know what the department thinks is a wilderness servitude. In 2001, when the federal government turned off the waters of the project, our local assessor reassessed the land that had been dewatered from $2,700 an acre to $27 an acre, a 99% reduction. The Oregon Department of Revenue challenged Reggie on that and said, you know, you can't do it. He said, I just did. Show me where I'm wrong. You can't grow anything else on the land without water, and Oregon's land use planning laws will not allow you to use the land for anything else, so it's $27. They backed off. So the Oregon Water Resources Department just finished recently finished a groundwater study with the USGS. And in that study, they determined that the regional aquifer discharges to some extent into the Klamath River, and the Klamath River is a scenic river. So during that four-year study, the department has postponed or delayed the applications for certification of several irrigation wells. Now that the study is finished, it's my understanding that it's the department's position they may not certificate those wells that are backlogged, and they certainly are planning not to certificate any more irrigation wells in an aquifer. So the question is, it's a multiple question, is the department, is it your intention to continue to deny these requests for groundwater rights on the wells that are already constructed? Is your intent to not create certifications for any new wells in the area? And is it your intent to withdraw the use of water from some of the wells that are constructed within a mile of the tributaries to Upper Klamath Lake? And we've even heard that it's your intention to withdraw the certification of all the wells constructed in that regional aquifer. So I wonder if on the record you could tell us what is your intention on those groundwater things. And the reason I bring that up, Phil, is because this community has already taken a hit of about $500 million. And if you take the rest of the water from them, it is a wilderness servitude.
So, Madam Chair, Senator, and I'm delighted to take a swing at those questions, because I think they're cogent and need to be answered. So after 2001, when the project irrigation shutoff occurred as a result of the Federal Endangered Species Act, there was tremendous groundwater development in the Klamath Basin. The department authorized, I don't have the numbers with me, but a significant number of wells on both project lands and off-project lands to give people a supplemental source of water should a shutoff of that irrigation project take place. So there were a significant number of permits issued. Any permits that were issued prior to the date in April that I'll refer to in just a minute, any permits that were issued prior to that time will stand today. Now, what happened earlier in the year was that after receiving the results of the USGS, Joint USGS Water Resources Department study that you referenced, Senator, after receiving the results of that study, it had been determined that the state, that groundwater usage had tripped the scenic waterway requirements in Oregon law that basically said we cannot allow more usage of the system where it will affect a scenic waterway beyond one CFS in amount. And there's another qualification there, but essentially it was determined through this groundwater study that we had actually triggered that one CFS. So what that prohibits us from doing by statute is granting new permits. So any permits that, any water rights that had gone through the process and become permitted, anything that had been approved, stands approved and is not affected by this situation. Anything that was still in the process, pending, or would be applied for in the future, where it was determined that there was a hydraulic connection between ground and surface water, and about 70% of the inflow into Upper Klamath Lake is from surface water ultimately, or from groundwater, excuse me. Anywhere that's been determined that there's a connection, then those new water right applications would not go forward. To the last piece of your question, would it be possible, and it's a little bit of an apple-orange situation, but could groundwater be regulated at some point in time as a result of the Klamath adjudication, I think was what you were getting to, Senator, in the last piece of your question there. And some groundwater, yes, could be regulated at some point in time in the future in favor of those senior surface water rights that we talked about earlier, if it's determined that, if it's determined scientifically, and this is a pretty high bar, that that regulation would result in a benefit to the senior water right holder that made the call. And so we would have to be able to show that regulating a well would get water into the surface water system that senior water right holder held a right on.
Representative, did you have a question? Because we have about time for one more question.
The Oregon Water Resources Department's final determination in the Klamath River adjudication appears to ignore its impacts on the Sprague River seasonal flows. In a riverine meadow system, flood irrigation seasonally recharges the water table, which is called return flows, basically. That recharge water table has historically enhanced stream flow later in the season. A USGS study by Turnin and La Tourneau quantified this. The increased flow is measurable, and this paper did quantify it. So the adjudication and subsequent calls on the water have virtually stopped flood irrigation. So results going to be a reduced seasonal flow in the Sprague River in August and September. The development of irrigation wells in the Sprague River valleys also measurably enhanced stream flows. That flow enhancement has been recognized by Pacific Power as a means to enhance their capacity to generate electricity on the Klamath River. Pacific Power expanded their contracts for low-cost power to include the off-project irrigators in the upper basin because pumping groundwater enhanced the downstream flow, enabling more power generation. So given these historical facts and documentation, how will curtailing surface and groundwater irrigation in the Sprague River Valley, which you have essentially stopped, result in enhanced stream flow to Upper Klamath Lake?
So, Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. And certainly the department would acknowledge that return flows are a reality in terms of water resource management in the state and an important piece of the water budget and water equation. The reality is, and the numbers show, that regulation has resulted in significant increase in stream flows throughout the system. And so I didn't bring those numbers with me today, but I can provide those to you offline if you like. But there's been a definite response to the regulation in terms of the stream system. So we have seen significant increase in stream flows in the system since regulation started. And as a result, Upper Klamath Lake would experience that same benefit.
Director, if you can provide that to Beth, we can get that information out. And I'm going to have to, because of the time, we're going to have to move on to our next subject. But what I'd like to do, Director Whitman, Richard, if you could follow up after your recommendations come out, and hopefully you'll have that in writing that you could send out, we can distribute. And I'm sure we'll be having some follow-up discussions, possibly, I don't know if at our next meeting, but if not, certainly we'll make sure to continue the updates for this committee. I think it would be very helpful. So with that, we're going to have to move on, given the time, to our next topic, which, gentlemen, don't move because you are up next. We're moving from the southern part of the state up to the northern part of the state with the Columbia River Treaty, and our guests are welcome to stay if they'd like to hear any of the other presentations as well. So if, we've requested an update from the governor's office and the department on the Columbia River Treaty process, which is coming to a head. As we know, we also have Bonneville Power Administration here, Cristobal, and we also have the Executive Director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. We can pull up another chair for you, Paul. We'll get that. And now you know we have a PowerPoint presentation, but if you want to go ahead and get started. Yeah, that would be great. We have a PowerPoint also that... Great. I'm glad you guys could all squeeze together. A little cozy up there, but I'd rather have everybody up there.
Thank you.
Spend some water.
Madam Chair, for the record, Richard Whitman, Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor. With your indulgence, I'd like to ask that we actually start out with Crystal Ball from Bonneville Power Administration, who I think is best informed to give us information about the process.
Never heard that one.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't. We won't let Senator House start making cracks about informing the future when we have Crystal Ball giving a presentation.
No. So Crystal is going to talk to you about process in terms of how we get to a final recommendation to the State Department.
For me.
Thank you. And this is a continuation of, we've had updates in the past, but certainly because of the timeliness, we wanted to make sure and inform the committee about what the latest discussions have been, and then also it was really fortunate we were able to get the director of the Columbia River and the Tribal Fish Commission to come and share the tribal perspective. You know, we also had hoped to have the Army Corps of Engineers here, and they were invited but couldn't make it in short notice. You know, it takes the federal government a lot longer to respond. We have figured out, so.
But you already knew that, didn't you?
Yeah, right.
I did.
Well, she is part of sort of the federal government. So with that, Crystal, thank you for being here on such short notice.
Yes.
Well, maybe we can dim the lights a little bit so we can see the presentation.
Chair Dingfelder, thank you for your interest in the Columbia River Treaty. And for the record, my name is Crystal Ball, and I am the Oregon liaison for the Bonneville Power Administration. The Columbia River Treaty is an international agreement that brings significant flood control and power generation benefits to the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada. BPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are responsible for implementing the treaty for the U.S. The purpose of the treaty review is to conduct the analysis necessary to understand whether it is in the best interest of the Pacific Northwest region to continue, modify, or terminate the treaty after 2024. The review has formed a basis for a regional recommendation on the future of the treaty that we will present to the U.S. State Department. The draft regional recommendation should be available for public review and comment as early as Friday this week, September 20th. The treaty review work has been coordinated through the sovereign review process. The state of Oregon has been well represented in that process. Our goal is to recommend a course of action to the State Department so that a viable treaty strategy can be developed by the State Department with substantial regional support. The U.S. entity is on track to deliver that recommendation by the end of this year. The State Department was in Portland just last week. At the meeting with regional stakeholders, the state outlined the process for what it will do with the recommendation after we deliver it to them. The Deputy Assistant Secretary said he was committed to transparency during that process. It was a great opportunity for the State Department to hear the different perspectives in the region. A draft, like I said, will be available for public review by the end of the week. We will take public comment on that draft through October. There will be public meetings. The last public meeting in October will be in Portland. There will be public meetings in the other four Northwest states during the month of October as well. The U.S. entity will then spend November reviewing those public comments and making any revisions that are necessary. And again, in December, we intend to deliver that recommendation to the State Department. We are on track. Chair Dingfelder, thank you for your interest in the Columbia River Treaty. I'll turn it over to the back over to the governor's office, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Just a little bit more about the briefings that were given by the State Department, Bonneville, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on Friday of last week. There were three detailed briefings, including briefings on hydro and power issues, flood risk management, navigation, and water supply, and also on ecosystem function. And stakeholders were invited to each of those three focused briefings. In the afternoon on Friday, there was then a more general opportunity for public comment and testimony on the Columbia River Treaty. And Oregon's lead representative on the CRT, Bill Bradbury, did sit in on all the briefings on Friday morning, and I sat in on most of the briefing, general briefing Friday afternoon, just to hear what people are saying, get a little bit of a flavor of what the concerns are out there so that we can have those in mind as we represent the state of Oregon in this process. I think you all know that the SRT process of developing a recommendation is a process where basically a mediated process so that I'm not able to say really anything in detail about what's going to be in the recommendation that comes out later this week from the Sovereign Review Team for public comment. But at a high level, the SRT and the lead entities have committed that, you know, part of the purpose of this process of taking it out yet again to another round of public comment is so that the recommendation really does truly reflect as much as possible a regional consensus, not just of the folks at the SRT table, but more broadly of all the interest, stakeholder interests that have a stake in the outcome of the Columbia River Treaty. For Oregon, you know, all of the issues continue to be important. We hear loud and clear from the power providers, particularly public power, about the current imbalance in terms of benefits under the CRT. We also hear from irrigators and from tribes also about the importance of water management in the Columbia and the need to more fully consider ecosystem outcomes for Columbia River management. And we also hear from downstream communities, including the city of Portland and others, about the importance of flood risk management and as well as navigation in the lower river. So again, we are trying to represent all those interests in the Columbia River Treaty negotiations. We will have another draft out at the end of this week so that folks who do have more specific comments or thoughts about where the draft recommendation should be headed or the position that Oregon should be taking, that's what this opportunity is for.
Did you have anything to add, Director?
Madam Chair, just one thing quickly for the record. I just would note in our prepared testimony on pages 5 and 6, attachment 1 articulates the state of Oregon's basic concepts of input into that recommendation. So you can review that one when you have time. Thank you.
Okay. And we're going to hear from Director Lumley, I have a question. It just occurred to me: does it have to be ratified by Congress? The treaty, the reauthorization of the treaty.
Go ahead.
Oh, you get to that, Chair Dingfelder. It depends. It depends really on what we recommend. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a different answer, Richard?
No. I think the committee members know, and the chair knows that. The Columbia River Treaty doesn't go away in 2024. Mm-hmm. So what happens in terms of congressional action really depends on what the State Department ends up negotiating with Canada.
All right. Well, we'll hand it off to you, Paul, and then we'll open up for general questions.
Not sure how to get this thing started.
We have a... Shelley, who will give you a hand there. And everybody should have a hard copy. Everybody up at the dais anyway should have a hard copy of the presentation. Great.
Great. Thank you.
And thank you for being here in such short notice. I know you have about 10 other places that you could have been today. So we're honored that you were able to make it.
As I mentioned on the phone, you were my excuse to cancel a trip. it does feel good to be back here again. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Lumley. I'm the Executive Director of the Columbia River Intertidal Fish Commission, and I'm also an SRT member. This slide shows the main elements of the treaty. The treaty came into force in 1964. There's no end date. The treaty also provided for the construction of four dams, three in Canada, one in Montana. The goals of the treaty were exclusively on optimizing hydropower and coordinated flood control. There's a 10-year notice in the treaty for either country to unilaterally withdraw from the treaty. The treaty changes in the year 2024. It doesn't go away, but the first opportunity to unilaterally withdraw will be September of next year. There's no mention in the treaty of the tribes, fish, or wildlife. I'm going to offer you a few slides on the tribal history and perspective here, taking a step back in time all the way to modern-day tribal culture, which is based on our first foods, water followed by salmon, game, roots, and berries. That's how we set our table in our longhouses. Our prayers, our culture, our stories are all wrapped around the Creator's gift of the first foods. The deal the Creator made with us as Native peoples is that if we took care of the first foods would take care of us. The tribes thought so much of this that they actually made sure it was reserved in their treaty language. This is the treaty with the Yakima Nation, the right of taking fish at all usual and accustomed places in common with the citizens of the territory and of erecting temporary buildings, procuring them together with the privilege of hunting, gathering roots and berries. These are our first foods. We signed our treaties in 1855. One thing we never expected was a dramatic decline in salmon runs. It's estimated there was around 17 million fish annually when the tribes signed their treaties in 1855. It declined dramatically even before the first dams came into place in the Columbia River, but the dams have held down the counts quite a bit. The primary losses before dam construction was overharvest in the ocean lower Columbia River and also to habitat destruction. These are the four tribes of Kritvik. The lighter shaded areas, the ceded lands that are defined in our treaties. The darker areas is the current day reservation boundaries. It's a significant portion of the salmon runs that still make it to this habitat above Bonneville Dam. This is a photograph of Slidell Falls. It was inundated by the construction of the Dalles Dam in 1957, eliminating a way of life for Indian peoples, not only in the Columbia River, but in the whole surrounding Northwest. It was a major gathering place for tribes for various purposes. Slidell Falls, not the only falls that was eliminated. Here's another example of Kettle Falls, which was inundated by the construction of Grand Coulee, eliminating the same kind of way of life for tribes up in that region. This is a photograph of the effects of a large dam that gets raised and lowered on an annual basis to comply with the Columbia River Treaty. This is a Spokane River right near the mouth. The reservoir is raised and lowered dramatically, and when it does, it exposes areas. On the left side, that's an old tribal village, and it exposes cultural resources. On the right side, there was a landslide. There are a lot of landslides when the reservoir is raised and lowered. This one exposed a burial site. There's also problems with reservoirs when the river bottom dries up. When it's lowered so much, it creates dust, especially in the upper part of this reservoir where there's up there by the Canadian border. There's a lot of contamination there from a smelter, Tecumseh, just on the Canadian side of the border. So some of that dust is even contaminated. When the treaty review became an opportunity, there were 15 tribes in the Columbia River Basin that formed a coalition, something we've never done before. We often would fight over the water. We would want the water for salmon, but that came at a cost to tribes in upper river locations who had to deal with havoc created by reservoirs that are raised and lowered dramatically. So we often fought with each other. But because of this opportunity, we all came together in one broad coalition formed in the year 2010. We often talk about the effects of these dams, the Columbia River Treaty, what it meant to people, but the reality is that there was a whole ecosystem there that had a dramatic effect, too. The ecosystem in many ways was destroyed, and so we're not the only ones. Tribal culture tends to believe that we, as Indian people, are part of the ecosystem, and so what happens to the ecosystem happens to us, and that's why we are all so concerned. Now, I tell you this information as a backdrop to this discussion, not because I'm expecting Oregon to do something here with respect to the tribal perspective, but to understand that when the treaty was signed in the 1960s, the federal government had a completely different mindset than it does now. Modern-day governance is a high level of respect for their trust responsibility to the tribes. So it is a different day. We have a new respect for Indian nations nationally, and we also have a lot more federal laws in place. We have the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, the list goes on. So it's a new day. Back to the treaty. I already went through this slide. These are the main parts of the treaty. There's one good thing here, at least, that the flood control benefits that we purchased was actually a pretty good deal, $65 million for the whole years of the treaty. That was a good deal. A couple of things that are not so good. One of them is that for the water that they store in Canada, they release it at a different time of the year that is a big benefit to the United States. And so we're supposed to share that that Canadian entitlement about 50%. So a pretty good chunk of resources, financial resources, goes up to Canada on an annual basis, estimated to be around $300 million. Not such a good deal. And also, after 2024, as Richard mentioned, the treaty doesn't go away, but it does change, and it changes in a way that can be dramatic. We have to manage all of our reservoirs on the U.S. side before we can call upon Canada for flood control. So reservoirs perhaps in the Snake River Basin that have never really been affected by the Columbia River Treaty, now we'll have to manage those reservoirs, draining those reservoirs before we can call upon Canada, and we also have to start paying for flood control. So the treaty changes in a bad way in the year 2024 for the United States. This is the makeup of both countries and how they implement the treaty. On the left side is Canada. On the right side is the United States. The U.S. entity was created by an executive order from the president. It defines the U.S. entity as made up as the Bonneville Power Administration Administrator, currently Elliot Mainzer, and also the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Northwest Division Commander, currently Colonel John Kim. Back to what the tribes developed, and as I mentioned, in the year 2010, when we formed that coalition, we completed a document called the Common Views Document, and that changed a lot. After that, then the United States entity came to meet with the tribes, and they asked us to help them develop a regional consensus. And in doing so, that's where the sovereign participation process was born. We agreed at that point that we needed to have the states on board as well as other federal agencies. So we started talking about adding Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana. The 15 tribes were organized in 5 distinct groups. Kritvik is one of the groups, and that's how I got appointed as an SRT member. And there's 2 tribes that are not represented by a tribal coalition. That's Cowlitz and Salish and Kootenai. I believe there are 9 federal agencies involved. We also met with Canadian First Nations on several occasions. We went up there and visited with them. They've come down and visited with us. It's remarkable how much we have in common. Actually, they all want the ecosystem restored. They want to see salmon returned, and they're very frustrated about what they have to deal with in these dams and flood control measures to keep Portland dry. A lot of bitterness in Canada, especially in the Columbia River Basin. The benefits of the treaty don't go to people in the Canadian Basin, Canadian Columbia River Basin. It goes to other places, the U.S. side, Vancouver. So they're very frustrated, and they want the treaty to go away. They want to give us the dams back. These were some of the things that we identified in our Common Views document, also setting aside our goals at the same time. The tribes obviously were not included in the treaty. In the treaty review, we'd like to be a part of the treaty review if there are any negotiations. If there's a new treaty, then we would like consideration to be on the new treaty. We'd like to make sure that ecosystem-based functions are included. There was also a pretty big effect on flood control, and it was eliminated the spring freshet. We'd like to see some of that restored. Also, restoring salmon runs to all historic locations, something that we'd like to see occur in this treaty, and it's something I've heard often from tribal governments that they did not have an opportunity to share in the benefits of the Columbia River system as it was developed, and there's a strong interest in that as well. A little more detail on what we mean by when we say ecosystem-based functions. We're talking about restoring and preserving natural and cultural resources, restoring the health of the estuary. It helps move fish out of the estuary, and minimizing the drawdowns in upriver reservoirs. This last comment here, a robust ecosystem-based assessment needs to be included. That was something that was actually in a letter from the U.S. State Department, so I thought I would mention that to you. And it needs to be co-equal with hydropower and flood control. This graph here shows the effect of the treaty. The darker blue area, the shaded area, that's the historic water, and that yellow sort of mustard color, that's what happened after the treaty came into force. So there was a really big difference. What happened was is the big peak was moved to a different time of the year. And in doing so, enormous floods were created behind these dams that that destroyed tribal villages, non-Indian towns, eliminated tribal access to the river, and destroyed an ecosystem. So there was a huge effect here, no doubt about it. And that flood still remains to this day, and this is the effect of creating a permanent flood. Flood risk management is something that is really a key part of the discussions that are going on right now. The flip side of flood risk management is ecosystem. The Corps of Engineers is reluctant to change their methods because of national pressure from major floods that occurred in other locations. Sometimes you will hear, you know, this term called flood risk management. Flood risk management is really risk equals cost times probability. You can't just look at the probability alone, because the probability of like an inch of water more is not that big of a deal if you look at the cost, if there's no cost involved. So in some cases, it's been not much farther from that as the truth. We've had reservoirs in upriver locations make great sacrifices just to keep a very, very minor flood from happening in Vancouver. A park bench might have been flooded. So when you look at the cost comparison, that's why you have to look at the whole thing. That's what flood risk management is all about. Why is that important? It's important because we want to restore the spring freshet. And we're not talking about flooding Portland. We're talking about more years where we can have more water for salmon out-migration so we can have wonderful salmon returns, runs like we're seeing right now, a record fall Chinook run. Sovereign participation process, there are three levels of that process. The government-to-government level, that's the decision-maker. That's one federal government, 15 tribes, 4 states. Sovereign review team, that's what I've been sitting on for the last 3 years. Technical analysis, primarily resolving process issues, but we really kick all the big decisions up to the government-to-government level. Then we have the sovereign technical team. That's what they've been doing all the modeling and analysis. And throughout this whole process, we've had stakeholder involvement. We've just finished 3 phases that we call them iterations. The first in 2012 is the baseline information that was created. 2013, we developed broad ranges of scenarios. And then just recently, we completed the more narrow range of options. On June 27, the first draft was released to the public for comment. That comment period is closed. The second draft, as Crystal just mentioned, is going to be out this Friday. There will be a 30-day comment period. The goal is to have a final recommendation to the U.S. Department of State by December of this year. I have some really good news to report. The region, the sovereigns, the stakeholders have all reached a consensus that the treaty needs to be renegotiated. I have not heard anybody this side of the border say they like the deal. That's a really good thing. If you go up into Canada, it's a little bit different story. The residents, I think, of the Columbia River Basin in Canada don't want the treaty at all. But the BC Hydro, who implements it, they're fighting for it. They want to keep the treaty the same. They don't want to change it. So there's a growing consensus for a new deal. What might be in that new deal? We don't know. But in terms of what the sovereign review team work product is going to come out, as reflected in the U.S. entity draft recommendation, it will include, most likely, including ecosystem-based functions, a reduction of the Canadian entitlement benefit. I think the power group would love that, and addressing flood control management post-2024, which is a big concern, should be a concern for the whole basin. Why is regional consensus needed? Well, it's the U.S. State Department that will make the decision on whether or not to renegotiate with Canada. That's not our decision. That's the State Department. We still need to develop a broad consensus on the details, and I'll tell you, we've got our work cut out for us still, because the power group has come out pretty strongly objecting to the inclusion of ecosystem-based functions. One way or another, though, if we do not reach that broad-based agreement in the region, we could really scare off the State Department. I can't see why they would want to enter into a negotiation with Canada if the region's not backing it or if we're still fighting. So we have to be really careful that we don't send the wrong signals to the State Department that it's impossible for us to develop this support that they need, and that support would have to come in the form of some broad consensus. So why modernize the treaty? Well, the Northwest depends on a healthy Columbia River system. It contributes hydropower for our energy independence. Flood control measures provide public safety, and the river provides broad economic well-being for the whole region. So a modernized treaty is not only in the best interest of the Northwest region, but it's also in the best interest of the United States. So our steps forward, the sovereign participation process or something like it is going to continue beyond 2014 if the State Department decides to go into a renegotiation process. Now, the three options are continue, which is really do nothing, because the treaty will continue with or without any action. Terminate, something I really doubt that the United States is going to go along with, because Canada is a friendly nation and we have a lot in common with them. I can't see the United States saying they will terminate the treaty. So modifying the treaty is the most likely outcome if we can reach a consensus. I like the other words that they're using for modify, enhance and modernize, and I actually heard those terms coming from Canada. Your question earlier, Chair, about the do we need Senate ratification? Well, we certainly would if under the Constitution if it was a new treaty, but even if there was a major change to the treaty, there's some that argue that we would need Senate ratification. So I would love to get to that question, get to a new deal with Canada and actually get the chance to ask that question, but first we have a lot of homework to do in terms of getting a regional consensus, which is key to continuing and convincing the State Department that this is the right way to go. Thank you.
Thank you for that excellent presentation and overview. I think it was one of the more succinct that I've seen, so appreciate that. Can we open up for questions? I have some, but I'll see if the committee has any questions.
I have one.
Senator Olson.
That was very good, Paul. It was an excellent presentation, but on your graph of the river flow, which I believe was on my page 10, could you explain that again? The dark blue is the blue line is the flow, and the yellow line is when we built the dams.
Mm-hmm.
Is that basically what happened?
Yes, that's correct. The blue shaded is prior to the Columbia River Treaty, and then the yellow is what happened right after the treaty. The other lines are some efforts we've made to restore some of the river management through various biological opinion processes.
So the question then is because we built the dams and we lowered the thing to the yellow line, that's impacted the fishery because it's pushed more water downstream earlier in the year?
Correct. During the spring freshet, which in our area occurs almost in the summer time frame, that's when the salmon smolts are being pushed out to sea. And when you create or slow down the water, it slows down the fish and dramatically change the way salmon survival occurred.
Okay, one follow-up.
Yep.
Can you kind of briefly touched on your one graph on the drop-off of the salmon fishery, the 17 million down, and you kind of just briefly said that it was overfishing. That's a lot of overfishing. Is that what was determined to be the cause?
It's a combination of overfishing in the ocean, the lower Columbia River, and habitat destruction. There was a lot of forest thinning or clear-cutting. So it's
along
habitat
the river?
Blockage and in river, it's primarily
along the Columbia River or the tributaries.
I'd say coast wide, but certainly in the Columbia River too.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, Senator Whitsup.
Thank you. I was also interested in that that slide on number three, because we too often in government base our actions on false assumptions. And in this situation, it appears that well over 90% of the decline in the salmon population occurred before ever dams were constructed. So you have to wonder how important the dams were. Also, your graph doesn't carry out beyond 2010. I believe the recovery has continued since then. So again, when we start talking about dams being a major cause of salmon destruction of salmon runs in the river, it occurs, most of it happened before the dams were put in.
I'd say you're correct. We did have some dams that started coming in around the turn of the century, but primarily it was prior to dam construction. And it is nice to see that we have a lot more fish these last few years. It might inch up a little bit over 2 million this year, which we'd be really delighted with. Thank you.
Representative, do you have a question?
Yes. A comment on the flood risk management. As a geologists, I think it's really important that we maintain the level of flood risk management the way they're determining it. And the Front Range of Colorado is a perfect example right now. In Big Thompson Canyon, we experienced probably a 100,000-year flood in the 1970s, and we're experiencing one again less than 40 years later. So just because you have something that hasn't happened geologically in the last 100 years that we've been able to see, or 150 years, doesn't mean we're not going to have two of those events that might occur in 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 years in the next 2 years in a row or next several decades. So thank you.
That was more of a comment.
Yeah,
it was
a comment.
All right, I do have a question, and I'm not sure, Paul, if you can answer this, but or anybody in the panel. And it was actually called out in your slide about the U.S. commitments, and you're talking about the payments for flood control benefits that's been paid out over the years, $65 million. What exactly is Canada using that towards? Is that being used towards habitat restoration? Does any of it go to the First Nations for compensation for their loss of tribal fishing? I'm just curious obviously, I don't know if that's in the treaty, probably left up to Canada to decide, but I've not heard anybody discuss what those payments are currently being used for.
I think it primarily goes to their equivalent of the Treasury. They do have a Columbia Basin Trust up there. It's not quite the same as our BPA-funded Fish and Wildlife Program because it's much smaller, for one thing, and it doesn't necessarily target habitat restoration or protection so much as it's community involvement. But somebody else in the panel may have more information on the Canadian.
Chair Dean Felder,
yeah.
Canada used the payment to build those dams on the Canada side. So they used the payment to build, actually, for the infrastructure to dam the river and to store the water.
Okay, so this is, and payments now, because these payments, I'm assuming, are continuing.
It was an upfront payment.
Okay. So there's not sort of a continual sort of maintenance payment that we're doing at this point.
I might be, Chair Dingfelder, the cost for flood storage, called upon storage, mm-hmm. would kick in after 2024 without amendment, at least, of the treaty. Mm-hmm. We'd have to start paying again.
Okay. All right.
No. Madam Chair, the second bullet here is what I was thinking about was the $300 million that we send up there every year. Sorry about that.
Okay. So one of the things that would be really helpful, I guess, Crystal, if you can follow up with Beth, when the proposed final draft, I guess it's a final draft or proposed draft?
Draft recommendation.
Comes out, if you can share it with Beth, and then we'll send that out to the committee to make sure that everybody gets the most recent. Well, everyone's phone's going off at the same time. Get the most recent recommendations. I'm sure we'll be having further discussions because as those recommendations come out, I'm sure there'll be more issues to discuss. Appreciate all of you coming, especially Paul on such short notice, and I think Crystal had even shorter notice, which was about an hour ago. We were lucky she was in the building. Certainly I'm sure there's going to be further discussions as we have the public comment period as well. And it's unfortunate it's only in Portland, obviously, for other parts of the basin. That's a long way to travel. But will there be opportunities for any type of virtual interaction, or is it just a formal town hall where you have to show up?
Yes, there will be at least four meetings in the Pacific Northwest, one for the state of Oregon in Portland. It will be web-based, and so lots of participation. I believe we had a lot of people on the phone on Friday for those meetings.
Great. And if you can send that information out to Beth so we can get that mm-hmm. to all of our constituents as well. We've been trying to keep our, certainly because of the location of my district, with lots of people who are interested, but other members may be interested as well, and we can share that with them.
Yes, Chair Dingfelder, of course.
Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and appreciate your presentations. And with that, we'll move on to our next part of our agenda. Thank you for joining us.
I'm going to have Crystal see me outside because I'm running next year.
You and Senator Hash. So
that's absolutely.
I know. That's her side business. So we're moving on to power. We're sort of transitioning from water to power. We have an update on Oregon's renewable portfolio standard. As you can see by the agenda, I've asked the Department of Energy and Public Utility Commission to come and provide us with an update from the state's perspective. And then we've invited the utilities, both private public utilities, to come and provide us with their perspective, and I'm sure we'll have some questions and hopefully a robust discussion. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Schwartz, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. Appreciate the opportunity to give you an update on Oregon's renewable portfolio standard. On the cover here of our slides, you'll see three of the projects that have been certified as eligible under the Oregon renewable portfolio standard. On the left, a digester gas facility at Tillamook. In the center, Seneca biomass project in Eugene, and the solar project in Joseph on the right. The renewable portfolio standard was enacted by the Oregon legislature in 2007. It requires Oregon electric utilities to deliver a certain percentage of electricity from renewable resources by 2025, with large utilities having interim standards. The goal here is to stimulate the development of new renewable resources. And so generally, energy facilities developed before 1995 are not eligible. An Oregon utility can comply with the standard in one of several ways or in a combination. They can build an eligible facility and acquire the eligible power and renewable energy certificates from it, or continue to operate one that qualifies. They can buy power and the associated credits from someone else. They can buy what we call unbundled renewable energy certificates. These are certificates without the underlying electricity associated with that. Or they can make alternative compliance payments, and they can actually use this money for energy efficiency or to build an eligible power plant in the future. Resources don't need to be in Oregon, but they at least need to be in the Western Interconnection. So that's all or parts of 14 U.S. states, the provinces of British Columbia and Alberta, and a little piece of Baja, Mexico. Here on this slide, you'll see an example of a facility that's located elsewhere in the Western Interconnect. It's the Raft River Geothermal Facility. It's included in Portland General Electric's 2012 proposed compliance plan. So the role of the Oregon Department of Energy is to certify facilities as eligible for the Oregon RPS in what we call the Western Renewable Energy Generation Information System, or REGIS. It's housed at the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, which is the entity that's responsible for reliability in the Western Interconnect. REGIS is a database and a system that issues, registers, and tracks all of the renewable energy certificates in the West to ensure there's no multiple counting toward programs that the certificates are used for. The certificates are really an electronic record of reported generation and the underlying attributes. The denomination is in megawatt hours, so one REGIS certificate is the same as 1 megawatt hour of eligible generation. And states and others use REGIS for two purposes. One, for compliance with programs just like this, Renewable Portfolio Standard, or for market-based programs like the green power you can buy from your local electric utility. The requirements by utility depends on the type of utility. Large utilities like Eugene Water Electric, Pacific Power, and Portland General Electric have to meet a standard of 25% eligible renewable resources by the year 2025, and there are interim standards. Today, the standard is at 5%, but by 2015, we're moving up to 15%. For smaller utilities, those that account for between 1.5% and 3% of electricity sales in Oregon are the folks that are listed there, Central and PUD and others. They need to meet just a standard of 10% by the year 2025. There are no standards before that time. And for smaller utilities, which are all the remaining utilities in the state, they just need to meet a standard of 5% eligible renewable energy by the year 2025. Built into the law are several flexibility mechanisms that make it less costly to comply and easier to comply. The Public Utility Commission next is going to cover the first two items here, cost limitation and alternative compliance payments. Importantly, unlimited banking of renewable energy certificates are allowed and uniquely allowed under Oregon law, so that utilities can bank eligible certificates all through time to ensure that they can comply in the least cost manner in the future. There are limits on the use of unbundled certificates for some types of utilities, for large utilities. The large utilities can meet up to, investor-owned utilities can meet up to 20% of their requirements through these unbundled certificates, and those tend to be less costly than bundled. Eugene Water Electric Board is a large consumer-owned utility, so it can use 50% of those certificates before the year 2020. And all the remaining utilities have no limits whatsoever on how many unbundled certificates they can use. And if a utility happens to grow from what we call a small utility to a large utility, there's a timeline that it gives them more time to be able to meet those more stringent standards. A host of eligible resources are allowed under the law: wind, solar, geothermal, ocean resources, municipal solid waste, a variety of biomass resources, including agricultural and forestry wastes, digester gas, and so forth. And hydroelectric also is eligible. We provided handouts to the committee of the full list of resources. There are three types of hydroelectricity that qualify for the renewable portfolio standard. The first are efficiency upgrades, and these are unlimited as long as they are made after January 1st, 1995. The second category is low-impact hydroelectric facility, and you see a picture here of a dam in Hood River Farmers Irrigation District, and this qualified in 2009 as a low-impact hydro facility. So this is an example of the kinds of low-impact facilities that qualify. There is a limit, total of 90 average megawatts per year that a utility may use to comply with the standard. Also, any new hydro projects, those that are built after, on or after 1995, these also qualify. If we look at the resources that have been certified so far by our department, on a megawatt share, on a nameplate capacity basis, we can see that wind predominates. But at the same time, hydroelectricity, about 13% of the nameplate capacity of facilities that are eligible and have been certified by our department, those have also been put in place. And if you break out hydroelectricity, looking at the chart on the graph on the right, you can see at this point, low-impact hydro is dominating among certified facilities, but that will change in the near future here. Looking at the facilities from the perspective of where they're located, you can see Oregon dominates, but there's also there are also facilities all along West Coast states, as well as in the interior of the West in Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah. A full list of the facilities that the department has certified is on our website at this link. And even though the law was just passed in 2007 and the first effective date was in 2011, there have been a number of changes to the law, and I've got a couple slides that detail those. I'll just hit some highlights. First, in 2009, there was a bill that requires Oregon's investor-owned utilities to meet a certain portion of the renewable portfolio standard with solar. They do receive two times the credit for those facilities. In 2010, there were four bills that amended the RPS. That last one I mentioned earlier, the last one on this slide, which allowed more low-impact hydro to qualify. Also in 2010, House Bill 3674 allowed some facilities that were older to qualify for the RPS after 2025, so specifically some biomass facilities and municipal solid waste. And then the last item on this slide is House Bill 2622 in 2011, which allowed any facility that used coal ended the use of coal and then switched to renewable resources to be able to qualify as a new facility under the standard. So my last slide here is just about specifically the consumer-owned utilities. And in terms of compliance, they provide their compliance reports to their members or their customers. Bonneville Power Administration is in the process of certifying efficiency upgrades for its facilities, and these will be quite large. For example, you see a photo here of the Grand Coulee Dam. That facility is on track to be certified by the upgrades there to be certified by my department next month. So as I mentioned earlier, we'll see that hydro portion of facilities certified by our department to be able to be used for the Oregon RPS. We'll see that portion from hydro efficiency growing. Right now, Bonneville is analyzing how many Oregon-eligible renewable energy certificates these upgrades will provide for their Tier 1 customer utilities, and then they'll then distribute those to their member utilities in Oregon. Thank you.
Is she handing it off to you, Jason, or?
Do you want to do questions first?
Well, are you finishing up the presentation, or you have a totally separate presentation?
It's separate.
Okay, so we go ahead. Do you have a question specific for Lisa? Sure.
Ms. Horchel, thank you very much for your presentation. On page 5 of mine, where you delay the requirements for utilities that grow, I have a concern if you have a utility in a small region such as Prineville that gets a major customer that comes in and zaps them with a big use. Now, as with PG and PacifiCorp, they can grow through growth in residential housing. Redmond or Prineville or some of those smaller areas that get this massive influx don't have that opportunity to grow through residential construction because people aren't moving there. They're moving away from there. So how does your delay help this utility, since eventually they're going to have to meet the RPS standard and cost the ratepayers dearly?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, thanks for that question. So the delay mechanism gives a local utility more time to be able to plan for whether they're buying more unbundled credits and trying to set up to do it most cheaply. So time does help in terms of setup. But at the same time, Governor Kitzhaber and Representative Smith have just convened a task force on the renewable portfolio standard to get all of the utilities together and their associations in the state, along with some of the other groups, public interest groups, and so forth, to look at how the implementation of the renewable portfolio standard is going so far, and how we're working toward achieving the goals under the law. And so to the extent that there are consensus-based changes that might arise from that task force that might, for example, address the issue you raised, that's the kind of thing that this group is going to be looking at.
A follow-up. Well, my question, I guess, basically was the fact that although you give them further time to look at ways to offset, it still puts a tremendous burden on the residents of that local market because it's going to be impossible. I mean, one doesn't anticipate Google coming in and dropping in a bazillion megawatt thing in your territory. And once you get it because you want to have it for the jobs, et cetera, how in the world are these small utilities ever going to be able to offset this RPS standard because their rates are going to go out of sight? So how do you mitigate that? How do you help them get through it other than give them a few more years to figure out how to pay for it?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, so this provision is in the law itself. Again, the idea here is that they will have more time, but at the same time, there were all those compliance mechanisms, the flexibility mechanisms, including the cost cap the incremental cost of complying with the RPS can exceed more than 4% of the utility's revenue requirements. So there are some cost-based provisions. They also can use unbundled renewable energy certificates to the greatest extent possible. So there are those mechanisms built into the law. But to the extent that there's a will and a consensus to move forward in additional changes, that would have to be a legislative change.
So there's no guarantee that their electric rates won't skyrocket, even with the little minuscule things we have built in?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, there is a provision that it's capped at 4%.
Right. It can't go above the 4% per the law. I think, Senator, what you're talking about is with the influx of data centers, there's been a concern about how that additional burden on the system is being spread among the ratepayers, and that's at this point negotiated among the different providers, but I think that's part of the work group that you're alluding to, and they're going to be looking at that. So,
right.
Did you have any other questions?
Well, I share the same concerns, and hopefully this work group can work them out.
Hey, Jason.
Thank you.
Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, I'm Jason.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Pardon? Did I say Commissioner?
No, that's fine.
Sorry. Chair Dinkfelder.
PUC, that's fine.
I'm Jason Eisler for... what am I? Utility Program Director of the Public Utility Commission. And I know your schedule is really tight, so I'm gonna roll through my slides. And it's mostly about the Commission's implementation of the Renewable Portfolio Standard. We are overseeing the investor-owned utilities, primarily in this case, Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp Idaho Power, as you saw in Lisa's slides, are down in the small utility category. So the primary oversight is over PGE and PacifiCorp. And we have essentially three overlapping processes that together relate to a full oversight over the RPS. The first one is the integrated resource plan, which is this 20-year look. It's really the core planning tool of the utilities that are regulated by the Public Utility Commission. In these IRPs, the utilities look at the load growth that they're going to have over the next 20 years and then plan to meet that load growth on a least cost, least risk principled basis. It's a 20-year plan with a 2 to 5 year action plan. These IRPs look at both demand side resources, energy efficiency, demand response, and supply side resources on an equal basis. The second process that we have is the RPS implementation plan. There's an initial plan that the utilities came forward. This is essentially an RPS roadmap. How is the utility going to meet the RPS in the upcoming years? The utility has to update this implementation plan every 2 years, and that RPIP, as we're calling it, must include the annual targets for acquisition of qualifying renewables. It looks at the estimated cost of meeting the annual targets, including associated costs like the cost of transmission and integration. So this is really the roadmap on how this utility is going to meet the goals of the RPS and a two-year check-in. And then finally, the third of the three processes is the compliance report. Every year, the utilities come forward and file with the commission a look on whether or not they are actually meeting the RPS goals. In this case, the Public Utility Commission looks at both the investor-owned utility, also the energy service supplier for those customers who may have chosen direct access. The Commission looks at a number of things to make sure that the IOU has complied. It looks at the bundled and unbundled RECs, looks at the numbers and quality of RECs for compliance, and looks at the development of various resources that the utility will need to undertake in order to meet the future RPS. So there are two sides of a coin here. One side is the cost recovery by the utilities itself. In the statute, it states that the utilities are to recover all prudently incurred costs of complying with the RPS in rates. This includes, in statute, costs associated with acquiring the renewable energy, the resource itself, interconnection, and transmission. An associated element of this is the renewable adjustment clause that ensures timely recovery of the capital costs of investment of that of a particular renewable energy facility, whether it be wind or geothermal, solar, et cetera. And that mirrors an existing power cost adjustment mechanism that the utilities currently have to recover on a automatic and timely basis of the variable costs that might be associated with fossil fuel facilities. So both fossil fuel facilities variable costs and the renewable facilities capital costs are recovered through automatic adjustment clauses, essentially in a comparable kind of way. And the flip side of this is the ratepayer safeguards. So to Senator Olson's point, there's a couple of safeguards built into the statute itself. The first one is this 4% threshold, so that the utilities do not have to comply with the RPS if the incremental costs of the program exceed the annual revenue requirement by more than 4%. And so at the commission, what we do is we look at the IRP and we essentially see what would the utilities' costs would be if they were to serve this growing load with a combustion gas plant, because that's the resource that's incremental. And then compare that to what the cost would be if the utility were going to go ahead and meet the requirements of the RPS. And so in that way, you're comparing that business as if you were investing in the gas plant versus investment in the renewable energy. The second ratepayer safeguard is the bank renewables. Lisa talked a little bit about this. I think there's a general recognition that the Oregon RPS is one of the more generous banking provisions in the country. If you are generating a lot of electricity from renewable resources early on, you get to bank those and then use them later to comply when the standards go up over time. So you get to essentially over-generate early and then use those to comply later. And then finally, the alternative compliance mechanism. This is in case of sort of an extreme market disruption. If the markets sort of grow crazy or if RECs become very high-priced, the utility can satisfy the RPS requirements by paying a per-megawatt charge that is established by the commission. The compliance status of the two IOUs, they're both in compliance as of 2011. 2012 compliance reports are currently before the commission, so the official compliance reports are back to 2011. The second bullet there, the incremental costs of the RPS were less than 1% compared to the business as usual or the alternative noncompliance scenario. Plans that PGE and Pacific Corp currently have to invest in renewable generation right now, building or planning to build, both of the utilities are going to be in compliance up until about 2020. So two quick bar graphs. This is PGE's system. Pacific Corp handles its data a little bit differently, so I'm going to just the trends are the same for both utilities. Here on a volume basis, these are the resources that are generating electricity in the PGE resource in the PGE territory. It may make a little bit more sense to go to the next one. These are the last 2 years. On a percentage basis of the system, you can see that renewable energy is now up into the 14-15% area. It came down from the previous year because of the water year and the amount of electricity that they can generate via wind is going to change each year. So you can see that we're not at the 15% target until 2015, and even then, I think both utilities are going to be using a fair amount of bank RECs to meet these targets. And so, in conclusion, at the commission, the regulatory processes are operating efficiently. As I said before, the IOUs are both in a position to meet the RPS requirements until about 2020. The incremental cost and compliance to date has been less than 1%. And the renewable energy of both systems has grown significantly from the passage of the RPS.
Thank you. Any questions for the PUC before we have the utilities come up? Senator.
I have one. Thank you, sir. What is the impact of the RPS been on the consumer rates to date and in the future? As compared to, say, a state that doesn't have the RPS?
Well, the third bullet here, that's still, I think it's still on there, the increment, so the, this is the incremental cost of compliance. So that would mean that the additional cost to ratepayers to meet of Pacific Urban PGE of meeting the RPS has been less than 1% on their rates.
But my question was, is that how does it compare to states that don't have the RPS? My understanding is we're about 20% higher. Is that, would that be true or accurate?
Chair Dinkfelder, Senator Olson, I think that in general, on average, Oregon's electricity rates are can be significantly lower than the national average and than many states. And it's sort of hard to compare exactly what causes rates to be higher than in one state or another state. I think the primary metric is, are Oregon's rates a lot higher because of the RPS? And our indications are no, it's been less than 1% higher.
Well, if you went back two or three slides, follow up, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. If you went back two or three slides on your thing there, you showed that all of those things are passed through the ratepayers, and all of those things cost money. And all of that regulation that the big IOUs have to do gets passed through to consumers. And I'm just wondering what those costs are. And I don't blame the IOUs because for certain they're allowed to pass it through, but the ratepayers are the ones that are getting stuck in the pocket for this stuff, and I'd just like to know what that cost is.
Chair Dinkfelder, Senator Olson, on a dollar basis or on a percentage basis? Because on a percentage basis, the law tells us we need to compare what would rates look like without the RPS versus what would rates look like with the RPS. And so we do that on a every other year basis, and it's less than 1%. So in terms of how much customers are paying more because of the RPS, it's less than 1%.
We have the utilities coming up. Yeah, maybe they could talk about the absolute numbers. So great. Thank you very much for your presentation. We can put the lights back up, I guess, unless they have presentations as well. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate your presentation. We have now the private utilities that will come up. We've invited Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp. Oh, you do have more presentations, huh? No,
one slide.
One slide, okay. Yeah. We can
they
handle that.
Yeah,
we can handle that. Okay, so whoever wants to start, and then we already have a question on the table, so you can talk about rate impacts, less than 1%, and what that is in actual numbers.
Great.
Thanks for coming.
Chair Dinkfelder, committee members, for the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of PacifiCorp. PacifiCorp serves approximately 1.8 million customers across six western states. You know us here in Oregon as Pacific Power, where we serve about 555,000 customers, mainly throughout rural portions of the state.
Except for my district.
And Northeast Portland.
it's because
Portland.
You live there,
yeah.
So you got it. Yeah, never mind. It is an odd oddity in the port. We are, yeah.
Did you do that, Senator?
No, it happened a while ago. There is a history there about why we are not part of Portland General Electric. But just how many customers in Northeast Portland? It's
variety is the spice of life. We're probably about 20% of Portland's customers provided. So a picture tells 1,000 words, maybe 2,000 words, considering how busy the slide is. But I think it's a pretty good way to walk through what the RPS in Oregon and, frankly, what our renewable procurement over the last 7 years or so has meant to PacifiCorp and its customers, not just in Oregon, but throughout the rest of our retail service territory states. So following up on the past two presentations, PacifiCorp has made a significant amount of renewable energy investment since 2006. You'll see these resources listed on, and I know it's going to be hard and strain eyes, but essentially we have clusters of wind projects in eastern Wyoming, in the Columbia Gorge area. We have some throughout eastern Idaho and a growing number along the Wasatch Front in Utah. We also have a pretty wide variety of resources. While wind is the dominant qualifying resource that we use for Oregon compliance, we also have geothermal, where we upgraded a geothermal plant in southwestern Utah. We have incremental hydro and low-impact hydro. In fact, we've sought to maximize existing hydro qualification as much as possible. We have some biogas contracts. We're also the largest biomass energy purchaser in the state of Oregon. And we have a growing solar portfolio. In 2012, we were proud to unveil our Black Cap project just outside of the town of Lakeview. It's a 2-megawatt project. And this year we'll be soliciting another 6.5 or so megawatts of solar to meet the Oregon solar capacity standard. I imagine you've probably got questions and time short, so I'll maybe leave with kind of three observations as we look at our experience. We will be compliant with essentially the resources you see through 2020, probably up till 2025. So sometime after 2020, we'll be back in the market purchasing new renewable resources. But for now, we've made a lot of early, low-cost, least risk investment. And in fact, Senator Olson, maybe to some of the questions you've had, when PacifiCorp procures, goes out, either contracts for renewable energy or builds and owns its own renewable energy, and it's about 60-40. We own about 60% of our qualifying resources. We get about 40 from the market. When we go out to do that, we do that on a portfolio basis across PacifiCorp. So we're not just procuring energy just for Oregon to meet Oregon's laws or just for California to meet California's laws or down the road. We're trying to find the best resource to serve the whole system across the western U.S. Those investments have been accepted for the most part into Oregon's rates as the least cost resource, as well as other states that do not have renewable portfolio standards. So Wyoming, Idaho, they've paid their share of those costs as well. And when you look at the six states that we serve, Oregon constitutes about 30% of that load. Over 60% is Utah and Wyoming. So even those western states that have a lot of fossil fuel generation located within their borders have also found that the wind investments in particular and the incremental hydro have all been prudent and least cost against their metrics as well as far as what should be accepted into customer rates. Couple of observations. The first is that, as you heard from Ms. Schwartz and Mr. Eisdorfer, Oregon does have a fairly comprehensive and I believe pretty flexible renewable standard. As far as renewable procurement policies that we see across the states, and we have several, Oregon continues to be, even at the 25% requirement, one of the more flexible and manageable ones that we've had to deal with. And by contrast, Washington has a 20% by 2020 renewable requirement, which is frankly much more difficult to navigate, has more regulatory constraints and not as many consumer protections built into the policy. California has been has been kind of like Mr. Toad's wild ride as they have continued to change their RPS almost every year since initially passing it just after 2001, and it's now up to 33%. Time will tell, and to your point earlier about how the impact of these policies on small customer basis, we only have about 47,000 customers in Northern California. Currently, we're meeting their renewable targets just on system resources, but there will come a point where the renewable requirement will exceed the capacity of our system to deliver it just as California's portion of what we have, and we'll have to start doing special things for California, and that's where we'll have to weigh costs and benefits. And thankfully, I think we have some flexibility in California with how we're regulated to make sure that, you know, we won't just drive people into bankruptcy trying to meet an environmental goal, but we'll actually be able to meet the state's goals and do so in a cost-effective way. The other thing is that one thing I'd like to point out is you'll see this big cluster of windmills with circles around them in the Columbia Gorge, Columbia Plateau region there. Those are Oregon small renewables. We interconnect with those projects. We do not receive the renewable energy certificates from those projects. So those projects in particular on this map are not helping us meet our Oregon RPS requirements. At this point, we really don't need them to. But I point those out because one of the things that we've experienced since 2006-2007 timeframe is a real growth of small community size renewable projects. And even though the Oregon RPS has a provision in it to encourage, I think, 8% target of the RPS to be met with small community renewables, it's kind of a mixed story. On one hand, I would be surprised if, you know, we may see more when small consumer utilities get closer to their requirements, but I'd be surprised if these small community renewables actually met the 8% that was envisioned in the RPS. But at the same time, small community renewable projects are alive and well and doing very well as far as their growth and the amount of just energy that we're interconnecting into our system. So it may be something for a future discussion about whether the Oregon RPS is the best yardstick to be measuring how Oregon's doing on small renewable projects, because the large utilities really don't need them, and that, frankly, there's more lucrative markets for renewable energy certificates from those projects than Oregon, and those RECs are finding those markets. The third point I'd have is, you know, as the amount of renewable energy grows in our portfolio, we're confronting the challenges that brings. They are intermittent resources. You can't just turn them on and off like you can more traditional power plants. And we're looking at different tools and different infrastructure investments to make those work better. The first is transmission. We know that we need to add to the grid, have more robust transmission access in order to get to areas of the country that have renewable resource opportunities that currently don't have transmission now. We're making some of those investments where they make the most sense. The other is understanding that these resources need to be shaped. And so, as our CEO, Pat Wrighton, has said often in public, you know, a commitment to wind is also a commitment to gas. You need to make sure that you have those backing resources. And so we're making those long-term plans to ensure that we have adequate dispatchable resources like gas to back up our renewables. And thirdly, not everything has to be done with steel in the ground. We're looking at enhanced market tools. So how can we operate our system, our balancing area, with other neighbors that we have in the region better to bring more flexibility to the system and lower costs for customers? And that's resulted in an announcement that we made earlier this year to partner with the California transmission operator, the independent system operator down there, to create an energy imbalance market. So how can we best leverage our transmission access, our system, to bring other people that may have a little bit of extra surplus energy at different times of the day into our system to balance out resources so we don't have to build another power plant or build transmission that would only benefit us and not necessarily the region. So those are some experiences that we're having. That's the lessons that we're learning, and so far so good.
Aaron, if you can go ahead, and then we'll see if there's questions, because we are starting to run short on time. Or I should say that Scott probably used up some of your time, but we'll try to make sure that you don't get cut off.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric. We serve about 830,000 customers, largely in the northern Willamette Valley. I agree with much of what's been said. We're a little less complicated of a story than my colleague here, but I will keep it brief and just ask, take questions. We did file our 2012 compliance report in June. We also largely depend on wind and hydro for our renewable requirements. There is some solar and some others in there, but wind and hydro is largely what we depend on. And in fact, looking out into the future, probably even more so dependent on wind, because of some of the hydro contracts, long-term contracts that we have, are probably going to be phasing out over the next few years. So we do plan to be physically compliant through the next target goal in 2015. We are building a new 267 nameplate megawatt wind facility in the state of Washington, just over on the other side of the Columbia River near Dayton, and that will put us in compliance through to the 2020 goal, when there would be need for additional investment at that point. I would really echo what Mr. Bolton has said about the variable nature. Again, as I said, we bring more and more of the wind onto our system to meet that. That variable nature does become difficult to balance, and we're also building additional gas resources now to have some of that flexibility in the system. It's interesting. We do have pictures that I didn't bring today that show at the time when our loads are highest and the demand is at peak is when at least the output from our Bigelow facility is low. So matching up that demand and balancing those resources is an issue going forward and will probably become more of an issue and take some of these additional tools to work through as those variable resources become a greater percentage of the system.
Did you want to address the rate impact question as well?
I don't have exact numbers that I could speak to, but I think what's important to note is that PGE, for example, is a short utility. So we would be building resources that would be flowing through to rates regardless. It would be a gas plant, as Jason said, and that's the comparator right now, or it could have been a wind farm. When we built Bigelow, that was the least cost resource in looking at other alternatives, including gas plants and things of that nature. So it's important to recognize that it's not just the new renewable resource that's being added into rates. It's something that would have, there would have been some cost that would have been built in regardless of the RPS.
Thank you both for the presentation. Any questions for either of them?
I've got sorry, I missed part of your I was down for a bill signing thing, so I appreciate Scott and Marion. As a proponent of hydropower, I've been hearing that some of the bigger utilities might have been telling their customers that they've already spent all of the money they need to build or buy the renewable energy that is required under the RPS, and thus they don't need hydropower. Is this true?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, I guess how I would characterize it is that we made a lot of investment towards new renewable resources as well as upgrading and maximizing the efficiency of existing resources that would also qualify. So in our case, hydro plants as well as a geothermal plant to get as much credit as we could. As you heard earlier, or may have heard earlier, the Oregon RPS does have very progressive banking standards. So you get credit for early action. It's almost like rollover minutes on your cell plan. If you don't use them all up in the early compliance years, you're able to roll those over later. So that compliance strategy has worked very well, I think, for the investor-owned utilities to have gone into the market, invested when gas prices in particular were quite high. So by comparison, wind and other renewables were very favorable and were the least cost investment. And we're going to be able to ride that investment for a little while until the standard starts creeping up towards 2025. So we're not in the marketplace to acquire new renewables right now. We continue to look at targets of opportunity. So if we can continue to invest in whether it's hydro or other plants that makes sense to get more incremental value, we'll do that. I don't think, we look at all these different resources on an equal basis. They all have value. They all matter to us. We have to manage the system. So we don't favor any particular technology over another.
Chair Dickfelder, Senator Hansel, I would tend to agree with what Scott has said. As I mentioned before, we are currently building a wind facility right now that will help us meet the 2015 target, and then we'll be looking again in 2020 when that standard raises to 20%.
Well, I guess, is there any assurance that you will not be coming back then for rate increases for increased renewable purchases down the road if you're meeting the needs now and not using hydro?
I would point to our integrated resource plan, Senator, which is mapping out over the next 10 years or 20 years what we think resource needs will be. And that's really our roadmap to when we think we'll need to go out and procure additional energy, renewable or otherwise. That's probably the best communication to our stakeholders of when we we'll probably be back looking at those resources. But I don't think I could give, at least speaking on behalf of Pacific Corp, I don't think I could give absolute assurance that if we didn't find a really good opportunity where it made, where there was a really strong business case to acquire another resource, that we wouldn't go acquire that if it made sense. Again, because of Oregon's regulatory policies, it's pretty consumer friendly in that no value gets lost. One of my great frustrations with Washington's RPS, to be quite honest, is that it only allows about an 18-month window of when renewable energy is generated and served to customers and when you can use credit from that transaction to count towards their RPS. I think that's really short-sighted, and it does leave value on the table when you have invested early and maybe have a little bit more than you need. There's a bit of headroom there that doesn't get used to meet a regulatory obligation, and therefore that customer value hasn't been optimized. Oregon standard recognizes that and should continue to. And so if we find, you know, a fire sale price, a really great wind project or a really great solar project that is lower cost than anything else, you know, it may make sense, and that would still go through a rigorous process at the PUC to determine if that was a good deal and whether customers should pay for it or not.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hanson, I would echo that and also note that it's not that the investor-owned utilities are not using hydro or not investing in hydro. We've done a number of efficiency upgrades. We have a low-impact hydro facility that we relicense where we can, and so we do have a commitment to using the hydro resources within our system that we have. There's not a lot of opportunities for new sizable hydro projects out there at this point, so that's why the focus has generally been on wind. But we're certainly not in any way walking away from hydro opportunities that are there.
Thank you.
And I'll have one last question in regards to net metering and distributed energy. I know if you have any updates on how your net metering programs are going. I know certainly PacifiCorp had a rocky start, but glad to hear that that's all been sort of in the past, and from what I haven't heard any complaints lately about it, but if you wanted to just mention about the fact that you are paying for energy that's being generated at local levels as well, and I'm assuming that's a very small portion of your load, but.
Chair Dingfelder, real quick on net metering, we are up to about 25 megawatts of installed capacity that we have with customers, whether through traditional net metering or through the Oregon Solar Initiative, which is quite a bit. And, you know, if you look, well, it's not there anymore, but if you look at the parts of the state that we serve, whether it's southern Oregon or central and eastern Oregon, we have a lot of sun in our service territory. And customers are taking advantage of the programs that are available to them. So we've seen a tremendous amount of growth, you know, really measured in the hundreds of percents of growth just over the last 5 years. Doesn't really contribute to our RPS position. The solar feed-in tariff does a little bit. We're working with the Department of Energy to aggregate that data and make sure that we can use, you know, the renewable certificates that come off of those small projects. But so it's not really a big part of our RPS picture, but it goes back to my earlier point that there's a lot more alternative energy finding its way into our system than just the RPS would allow you to believe.
Did you want to comment on your program at all?
I don't really have anything to note. We've seen large growth in the program as well, but I don't have anything else.
Great. Well, thank you both for your input today and an update on where the IOUs are and meeting the renewable portfolio standard, so appreciate it. And we're going to hear, last but not least, from the public utilities. And unfortunately, we lost one of our members to illness. Jason Hauser from Eugene Water and Electric Board won't be able to join us today. My understanding, he's ill. So we're going to hear from the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association and the Oregon Rural Electric Co-ops. Thank you. Welcome, and whoever wants to go first.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Senator Olson, members of the committee, I'm Beth Vargas Duncan with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We're a statewide association with 11 members. Eugene Water and Electric Board has already indicated is independent of OMEU with their own representation. So very briefly, as we are short on time, all I want to say is that our members are working with BPA in their hydro efficiency upgrades, and we're all small. We have two medium-sized utilities under the RPS, and we're all on track for meeting the requirements. So, I'll take any questions.
Why don't you go ahead, Ted, now we'll see if there's some questions.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. I represent 18 electric co-ops in Oregon, 200,000 members, about 30,000 miles of line. I will be brief as well. We take our obligation to the RPS statute very seriously. In fact, we were developing renewable generation before the statute was enacted. We have invested in landfill gas around the Corvallis area. We're developing geothermal down in Lake County. We've put about $500,000 into the Ocean Power Technologies Wave project off the Oregon coast. So we're actively trying to comply with the 2025 mandate. Most of my members are in the smallest, the 5% that has no interim targets, but they're certainly, you know, making plans, talking about how they're going to comply with that. Just a couple observations about the RPS. We heard Beth talked about it, and Director Schwartz talked about the hydro upgrades off the federal system. We are working actively with ODO and BPA to see what we're going to get off Grand Coulee and Bonneville and other projects up there. It is too early to say what we're going to get as far as renewable energy credits. There's been information out there that we know exactly what we're going to get. We don't know. Bonneville doesn't know. ODO doesn't know. This process has been very slow and laborious. I do give Director Schwartz credit for speeding this up. I think we've lost some opportunities. We've lost some RECs as a result of these delays. So we're looking forward to getting those RECs going forward. The second observation has already been talked about here. We've seen a situation where these data centers have moved in, particularly the Eastern Oregon, certainly Senator Hansel's district out there, some in Central Oregon, and created a very interesting situation where the growth has just exploded on these systems that thought they were either going to be in the middle tier or even the small tier. And so we're really looking forward to this work group, this task force that has been referenced earlier, to try to see if there's some targeted solution to deal with an inequity where you'd have, and certainly Senator Hansel's area, where you have a less than a 10,000-member utility that has the same obligation as somebody that has 830,000 members. So I commend the governor, and I commend Representative Smith and others for convening this task force. We're part of it. And we look forward to working with a broad range of folks to see if there's some targeted solution that we can bring forward to the legislature to address it. So thank you.
Questions? All right. Well, thank you very much for being here today and sharing your perspective. And I know, although, like you said, the RPS doesn't kick in with your folks until 2025, really appreciate the work that you're doing. And certainly, as far as the work group that you'll be participating in, we'll be hearing updates along the way. So thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. So with that, we're going to move on as we're running short on time, and we're going to switch to the forest fire season update, and then, which we have about 15 minutes, and then the Global Warming Commission, so we hope to get folks out of here on time. As we wait for the room to clear out, we will get the presentation. You want to hear about fire?
You do until 5.
I know, but I'm going to try to get done at 4:30. Yes. And did you want to try to get a hold of Senator Bart Sugar? Because he wanted to be here for that. Bart Sugar, I'm sorry. Yeah, so you may want to just call his staff. All right, so welcome. Thank you for your patience. And we'll see if we can get the room quieted down back there. Thank you, gentlemen. We still are in the middle of a meeting here, and I've asked the Department of Forestry and the state forester to come and give us an update on forest fire season. I will tell you, it's been quite a season all throughout the West. I started my time off riding in western Montana. I feel like the fires have been following me because I started in western Montana, literally driving into Montana and saw this fire that had just started a couple of days ahead of time. So I got to see the plumes through a week of cycling and was watching the planes dipping their water buckets and trying to put out those fires. And then I ended my summer with a proposed backpack trip in the Sierra Nevada that had to get rerouted because the Yosemite fire. So I sort of felt like it followed me from Montana, but it's indicative of the fire season this all over the West. And so certainly in regards to the amount of damage that's been done, but also the cost of the state. And I was going to say Senator Hansel and I both sit on the Ways and Means Committee, and we know very well about the fire protection program and what the costs to the state have been in the past. So that was part of why I wanted to have this presentation as well, is to hear what we're in store and efforts to try to keep those costs down for the future. So with that, and welcome back. See, I stalled just in time so we can make it back for the presentation. So we have a guest senator who wanted to be here to listen and be able to ask questions. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here today.
Okay, very good. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker.
Can you just pull the microphone a little bit closer, Doug? Thank you.
My name is Doug Decker. I serve as Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. Based on your travel plans and your alignment with smoke, I'm tempted to know about your travel plans for the next month, but I won't ask. All right. So I'm joined here this afternoon by Nancy Hirsch, the chief of our Fire Protection Division, and Travis Medema, deputy chief. And our purpose is really to provide you an update on the status on the 2013 fire season, which has been notable and historic for several reasons. We've been with you before describing the work of the Department of Forestry. You know, we're the biggest fire department in Oregon. We protect 16 million acres of private, state, and BLM forest land statewide. Responding to fire is the cornerstone of our agency. It's the reason we were organized in 1911. We almost double the number of agency employees during the summer to help with our seasonal firefighting workforce. Another cornerstone for us in our fire business is the working relationships that we have with our fire partners. First and foremost, the forest landowner community, the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office, and all those in the structural fire community, the federal fire agencies, our Oregon Office of Emergency Management, the Oregon National Guard, and others. Oregon has an extremely capable, complete, and coordinated fire protection system, and all those pieces were in play this summer, every piece. So we're before you to talk about the historic nature of this fire season. I think this is a season that many of us are going to be talking about for a long time. It's kind of a point of reference. In my 26 years with the Department of Forest, I've never seen a fire season like this one. Really, no matter how you look at it, 116,000 acres burned is the largest number of acres burned we've experienced on state-protected land since 1951.
That was in Oregon alone you're talking about.
In Oregon, right. And so 1951, that was the fourth of the series of Tillamook burn fires. $120 million spent. It's the most expensive fire season that we've ever seen in terms of fire costs. It's also been a time of excruciating loss. We've had four firefighters here in Oregon have died in the line of duty. It's been one of our deadliest fire seasons on record. The fatalities have shocked us all. The fatalities started out in Arizona with the loss of many members of the hotshot crew in Arizona, and we continue to find ways to show our respect to the victims and the families and the colleagues, and we also look for ways to honor all of our folks who operate in harm's way. In addition to the human toll that we've experienced this season, the losses have been significant, really untold financial and resource losses in terms of timber and other values, which has already and will have an impact for decades on forest landowners in western Oregon, eastern Oregon as well. We've experienced significant tourism losses, particularly in communities around the Rogue River that was shut down for 10 days during the worst of the Big Windy Fire. Significant smoke and air quality impacts to our communities, particularly across southern Oregon. So really, by every measure, this is a fire season that we are going to be referring to for many years. So Travis and Nancy are going to lead us through a look at how the season shaped up, how we prepared for it and got ready for it, and how we've responded, as well as the pathway ahead. We're not out of the woods yet. We've got probably another month plus of fire season. So with that, we'll go to Travis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Medeman. I'm the Deputy Chief, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here with you today, and we're going to walk through a couple slides. This first slide really characterizes wildfire risk, and is something that is we track annually, and really, as you can see early on, it had Oregon painted as an above-average fire season and potentially extreme season. This is a combination of fuels, weather conditions, temperature, moisture, and all of these are really critical drivers in fire season. It also includes the component of drought, which is a major driver in fire season, which, as we heard earlier today, has been in Oregon over the last few years and continues to intensify. Again, early on in July, predicted to be a very active fire season, and as we know now, it was absolutely correct in the prediction. So to start out, May and June were kind of the first two chapters, as we've characterized, one of the worst fire seasons in the last decades. We had numerous 200-plus acre fires in both our southern Oregon districts and also our Douglas Forest Protective Association, and it was really a preview of what was to come for the 2013 season. This picture is a fire in our Douglas Forest Protective Association, and you can see some pretty substantial fire behavior in May. And as we moved into July and August, conditions only increased and worsened. I heard earlier today, and I say this, a picture's worth 1,000 words or a couple thousand words, and as I look back at the 2013 fire season, this is really a picture that speaks volume about the fire season. So we moved into July, conditions worsened, and activity picked up, especially in Central Oregon, Southern Oregon, and also Douglas Forest Protective Association. We sent our first incident management team out on July 14th to a fire in Central Oregon called the Box Springs Fire. On July 20th, another fire occurred down outside the town of Williams called the Pacifica Fire. It was 500 acres and required the evacuations of numerous residents in Williams. And this slide, as I said, a picture's worth a 1,000 words, really highlights the extreme fire behavior. This is a 300-plus foot fire whirl that's coming off of a portion of a unit there. And really, it's sobering as you look at that, the sheer intensity of that, the devastation, and what that extreme fire behavior means. This is extremely rare in the fire world, and it takes a combination of extremely dry fuels and also severe weather to create fire behavior like this. So as we move to July 26, a set of rare and unique weather conditions occurred, producing a very efficient and effective dry lightning storm. And when you talk about dry lightning, those are two words you don't want to have, efficient and effective, meaning that you get a lot of starts without a lot of moisture, and it causes a lot of fires. This led to about 80 fires in our Southwest Oregon District and Douglas Forest Protection were sparked by this storm, and it really, in my mind, shaped what the next 2 months would look like. Only a few of those fires became large. However, they were the headline fires for the next few months. And the key point here is there were many, many fires that didn't make the news, and those were the fires that were stopped before they grew over 10 acres. And that's really at the cornerstone of our business, is putting fires out at the smallest size. Due to extreme fuels and weather conditions, stopping those hundreds of fires before they came large is truly a testament to the young men, women, that were out on the front lines, along with our cooperation with our landowner partners, and then also all the private entities that help us out when we get very active fire seasons. So this is a little bit of a busy chart, but it's important, I think, in that this talks about an energy release component. And if you think of energy release, it's really around fuel moisture conditions and paints a really good picture of how hot a fire will burn. And it's got factors that include, you know, what the weather's doing, any long-term drought, moisture, and really kind of is a good indicator of how hot a fire can burn and indicates when we may be at risk for large fires. This is specific to Southwest Oregon District, and you can see we've highlighted it was at a peak for a 10-year high of an energy release component. So the fuels were absolutely ripe at that period. And that coincided with that lightning event on July 26, which really created havoc in that landscape. So the Douglas Complex. Out of that lightning event, five fires or complexes of fires emerged that threatened ODF protection or were on ODF protection. The first was the Douglas Complex. The second was a fire called the Big Windy. The third was Brimstone. The fourth, Whiskey Complex. And the fifth, Labrador. This picture is from one of the heavy air tankers on July 26, looking at two different fires, Rabbit Mountain Fire and the Dad's Creek Fire. They essentially ended up at the end about 25,000 acres each. At one point, the Douglas Complex had more than 3,000 individuals on it. As State Forester Decker said, our organization expands. 3,000 folks are more than double all department personnel. If you were to take one step back and talk about those five fires, at the peak for the operations in that theater down in southern Oregon, there were more than 6,000 folks working those incidents. That's more than quadruple the entire Department of Forestry working fires down in southern Oregon. The last kind of factoid around the Douglas Complex is it was the number one fire in the nation for 11 days, and that's one time when you don't want to be number one. It means you have a very, very large fire and a very complex fire. This is a vicinity map, and this map kind of puts those fires in context. As you can see, the very north end of the map is Roseburg. That's the I-5 corridor going down to Glendale and then south down to Grants Pass, so kind of paint the picture of where those fires were. What I'd highlight on this map is the ownership, and you can see the white is private land. The kind of peach color there is BLM land, and then the green is U.S. Forest Service. I'd highlight that checkerboard pattern. Those are the ONC lands, and those are lands that we provide protection to via a 50-plus year BLM contract. Kind of the next chapter in the 2013 fire season is in August, the east side of the state reached its peak. With two significant large fires emerging, again sparked by lightning. There was more than 7 days consecutively that the east side had lightning, and out of those seven consecutive days of lightning, two fires emerged. One was called the Grant County Complex, and the second fire was the Government Flat Complex outside the Dalles. Together, they totaled around 25,000 acres. While large fires have dominated the headline, over 1,000 fires were stopped at initial attack or under 10 acres. And there's numerous success stories out there and great saves that occurred because of aggressive initial attack, working with our landowner partners, and then also the severity resources, and I'll talk about those next. That combination ultimately ended up saving millions this fire season, and that doesn't even account for the natural resource values that didn't occur because of stopping fires when they're small. This is a picture of a single-engine air tanker, so a smaller air tanker, and this was actually added through the Wildfire Protection Act, which I'll touch on next, which was a piece of legislation in last session.
So is that actually state-owned or contracted?
It's contracted, and it's in LeGrand. We brought on two of these single-engine air tankers, and it's all through a contract.
I thought maybe Senator Burchard was in that one. I thought I saw
So here's a picture of those severity resources. On the top are those smaller air tankers. On the bottom are the large air tankers, and they have absolutely been critical this fire season. Historically, we've had those two large air tankers on the bottom along with three helicopters. With the addition and the dollars in the Wildfire Protection Act, we brought on those two smaller air tankers, also two additional helicopters, and a Type 3 helicopter. Due to the severity of the fire season and the sheer volume of fires, we also added additional aircraft, including another large heavy air tanker and then also a Type 1 helicopter. So significant amount of resources available for initial attack. In total, those severity resources flew more than 1,000 hours. That's a significant number exposure for those aircraft. The air tankers dropped more than 352 loads of retardant. That's about 850,000 gallons. And the helicopters put more than 1 million gallons of water on fire through bucket drops. Those are pretty significant as you talk about initial attack and supporting incidents and stopping fires. In totality, almost 2 million gallons of aerial delivered water and retardant from these resources, and they've absolutely been critical as we look at the 2013 fire season. And with that, I'll turn it over to Chief Hirsch.
Thanks, Travis and Doug, so far. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch, Chief of the Fire Protection Division for Oregon Department of Forestry, and basically going to try to wrap up here with still preliminary numbers, but some key statistics in regards to also to costs and losses, and provide an overview of some themes. So first up here is really a slide that shows lightning strikes, of which Travis talked about a particular event on July 26th of having, you know, major significance in our fire season. But the other significance that this shows is that essentially we had double the lightning in the Pacific Northwest this year than the 10-year average, that Pacific Northwest including Washington and Oregon. Again, while a few catastrophic large fires have captured everyone's attention and really have driven the workload this summer, still about 94% of our fires have been caught at that initial attack phase, 10 acres or less. And that's, given a year like this one being such a challenging one, speaks volumes to what happens day to day, day in and day out at the local level with our base level of protection resources combined with those statewide severity resources. So let's take a look next at the total fires to date. So again, this is through last Friday, I believe, but we're just at 1,083 fires, and Doug, State Forester Decker touched on, we're at about just a little over 116,000 acres burned. Of significance, again, I would point out 45% of those fires have been caused by lightning, which is actually up about 15% than a normal 10-year average, where about a third of our fires start from lightning. Let's go to the next one. Okay, so this slide, we bring in those acres burned, which is essentially the red line here. And we also bring in large fire costs, which I know is of great interest to each of you. This chart shows the gross large fire costs adjusted for 2013 dollars, and the blue bar represents the costs. The dollars there on the left. I will tell you that 2013 bar is showing right there at about 110, 113 million. We're actually right about 120 million right now for gross large fire costs for this fire season. And again, the acres are there for you to see, and we've talked about 116,000. You can see the significance of the 2013 fire season in comparison to the last 12 years. These large fire costs do not account for any reimbursements either from our federal counterparts and specifically from and through FEMA, where we've applied for and been granted federal management assistance grants, and I'll talk about that in the next slide. Okay, you've seen this chart in the last legislative session. Unfortunately, we have to talk about it in what it means in terms of implementation when you have large fires this year. So the chart basically represents how Oregon annually prepares to pay for fires. How I look at it is that it's the policy framework that essentially the legislature has adopted and approved. And honestly, it's worked quite nicely. Most of the fires are, again, caught at that base level of protection, which essentially is the fire department, combined with the statewide severity resources, the program that Travis just walked you through. And I would say I wanted to emphasize one point here. You know, you can't have statewide severity resources and not have the ground forces, and you can't be as effective if you only have the ground forces and you don't have the statewide severity resources. It's really the combination of those that I think makes ODF pretty unique and gives us the ability to keep a lot more of the fires at a smaller size. So the few that were not caught, unfortunately, have added up to a significant large fire cost for 2013. And as I said, they're right around $120 million. Now, the net estimate is right at about $73 million. So you take the $120 and you reduce that by what we are estimating in terms of Forest Service federal recovery dollars, as well as through our FMEG FEMA processes. And you end up, again, with this $73 million. So what you're looking at there then is, okay, we have that annual insurance policy. The policy is $25 million after a $20 million deductible. So we've essentially
gone through that for large fire costs this season, and currently there's an estimated $28 million left in additional large fire costs. And so these are preliminary numbers. Our department will be returning back. In fact, we'll be in front of Ways and Means tomorrow, but be requesting to come back in November and fully expect to return again in February to begin the long-standing conversation there around how to pay for these additional large fire costs.
I want to just point out here, and I know you've seen this chart before and I'm familiar with it. This is kind of a representation of being ready. Oregon has a framework unlike any other Western state. We're kind of the envy of my colleagues, other Western state foresters, to be able to actually have the resources, have the support, and have thought through how are we going to be prepared for a bad fire season. The federal government has tried to implement something called the FLAME Act, F-L-A-M-E, FLAME Act, and it's designed to try to have some funds available to help in the event of, every 10, 12 years we have a situation like this. They've not been able to fully fund that. And there are no other Western states that do that as well. So the work that we did with that you helped do with the Wildfire Protection Act this last year was critical in having this framework in place so that we aren't further in the hole, both in terms of dollars spent as well as additional fires that we could have seen had we not had this Verity resource.
Okay, so both Doug and Travis have touched on loss lightly so far, and I cannot begin to give due justice to the losses that are out there. These photos I actually took just last week. I was out on the Douglas complex with both two of the largest industrial landowners that were impacted there, Roseburg Forest Products and Plum Creek. And essentially, these are photos from that visit, primarily there on the north end of the fire. But it's hard to look at 50,000 acres in a day when you're down there in southwest Oregon in the magnitude of that footprint. These losses are devastating and significant to both private and the public. The State Forester Decker mentioned earlier the magnitude of the acres that we protect and the overall estimated value of that at $60 billion. For landowners, they've lost their upfront investment of having green growing trees out there. They've also lost the time that they have to do, the time they have to give up in terms of having to restart. And then lastly, they're now in a position to essentially need to reinvest new dollars to get these forests back and green, as well as make them again working forests. State Forester Decker also talked about the tourism impacts, recreation, particularly here in the Douglas complex. We had the railroad shut down for a number of days. They actually got in there and were able to fix that pretty quickly. But it's those kinds of things, infrastructure-wise, that the community is hit with in terms of hard impacts. And we'll go to the next one. So partnerships. Landowners, as we've touched on many times, have been critical and historic for us as an agency in terms of maintaining our success. They bring not only equipment, personnel, but they also bring local expertise, and much of this is often in kind. This year, once the governor's office issued a proclamation of a state of emergency due to the imminent threat of fire, we were able to implement what's called Operation Plan Smokey. Essentially, what that brings to bear for us then as a partner are the National Guard resources, and we utilize them two times this year, both down at the Douglas as well as the government flats. We also worked very closely with our partners at the Oregon State Fire Marshal Service. You'll notice a number of these fires this season that went from extended attack. Pacifica, we talked about earlier, homes being evacuated. Oregon State Fire Marshal's office was mobilized four times, four different incident management teams combined with ours to focus on the structural fire protection. The national system was huge in bringing to bear when you have the magnitude of these kinds of fires. It's a system that's there. Normally we don't have to use it, but because we're a part of that system, we're able to tap it and bring hundreds of other people from out of state. Particularly of interest is the Northwest Compact, where we can actually tap into more local resources in our neighboring states as well as the Canadian provinces. And I will say that Canadian provinces brought critical mid-level overhead talent and leadership into the organizations that really allowed us to use effectively the contract crews, and they came from Saskatchewan, Alberta, and the Yukon. And then, as I mentioned there, the contract crew community, as well as the engine and tenders. This year, we had Department of Forestry administers the crew agreement. We had about 150 crews in the system. We actually went out an extra time and I think brought in about 10 more. But at one time, on one of our fires alone on this Douglas complex, we had close to 100 crews working on it. So huge contributions by not only the broader contract community, but by locals that bring to bear those resources. And lastly, just also mention that Office of Emergency Management did a significant amount of coordination and helped bring to bear other state agency resources and expertise to backfill with some of our folks being out on the line. Remaining fire season, if it feels outside like it does in here today, I think we're going to be okay because it was pretty cold in the back of the room. But I don't think that's the case. Conditions have moderated. It appears that a more normal late summer fall pattern is setting up. That all said, for me, I don't feel like we're completely out of the woods yet. One few days up and coming weeks in front of us, if we get an east wind event, things could and would dry out, and we would be right back in business. So until we see really a significant amount of fall rains, we'll be ready to respond. Lastly, themes, a lot from such a complex, challenging fire season. But I think really specifically the weather, fuels, and lightning are the big ticket items that drove this fire season. Our partnership with landowners remains strong and is strong, as even with the result of and the magnitude of losses that we incurred this fire season. We worked very closely with our landowners on both pre-season and during the season to bring them in and incorporate them in as fires emerged. Large fires make the headlines, but initial attack is really where we see our success. And for this year, we have over 1,000 fires of the 1,083 that we kept at a small size before they became large, damaging, and costly. Severity, again, we touched on, critical in terms of our success there. 2013 will go down as one of the most challenging fire seasons in recent history. Many have referred to it, 2013, as 1987, some of you may remember that, just a month earlier. So we learned a lot from that fire season, and in fact, it really positioned us better for what we encountered this year. So bottom line, it's been challenging, it's been historic, and something I hope that you will remember that I want to leave you with is that we often have conversations with all of you about the complete and coordinated system. That's what you all have provided us in Oregon statute. And that system has worked. You know, we like to keep 94% to 97% of our fires at 10 acres or less, which means we're not having to tap into all of these other things. But statutorily, you have provided the foundation that allows us to adapt or ramp up where we need to and ramp back when we need to. And I just want to say thanks for that and the solid support that we receive. Be happy to take any questions.
Thank you for the excellent presentation and overview, and appreciate you being here. I know it's been a rough season, and we're probably looking forward to a little break when the season's over, but I don't think we're out of the woods yet, like you said. So questions for the department?
Just one. Something you just said in your conclusion that really struck a chord with me. You said unusual weather, fuels, and lightning combined together, and I guess as I look at it, we can't do anything about the weather, we can't do anything about the lightning, but we can do something about the fuels. And I just hope that we are not back here every August or September talking about these catastrophic fires. I appreciate all the efforts you've done and continue to do and be commended, but we've got to, I think, in good policy and forest management, we've got to be able to do something about the fuel load prior to the fire season. Otherwise, it's a never-ending cycle. Plus, we can use it productively. Any comments?
Madam Chair, Senator Hensel, excellent point. You know, an ounce of prevention is definitely worth a pound. We're working very carefully, closely with, particularly with our federal partners. You know, 60% of Oregon's forests owned by the federal government. There's a project up in your neck of the woods, our cohesive wildfire strategy pilot project in the Blues, that has at its core trying to create more fire-resistant, resilient landscapes. And a huge aspect of that is fuels management. Over this last season, the Forest Service has gone through four different kind of fire transfers out of fire of non-fire related programs to fund the fire program. And actually, I was back in D.C. the first week of June testifying before Senator Wyden's committee, talking about the need to hold the line on fuel. On fuels reduction funding. I think that there is a clear understanding amongst the local managers within many of our federal neighbors. I think in many cases it's a question of resources, and it's our obligation to kind of hold the line on the policy side of that as well. And so we've done that. The governor's office has helped with that. The Council of Western State Foresters is doing that as well, and we recognize that managing the fuel and you know, taking an active hand there, not only in terms of preventing additional costs and loss, but also leading to the social, economic, and environmental benefits we need from those lands. Very important.
Other questions? Senator Olson and then Senator Bercher.
It was quite interesting. I was coming back from Redding, California, and we were headed over to the coast, and I decided to turn and go up the Rogue River. Right. And we went up the Rogue River, and the little map kind of quit, and we have GPS in our car, and we drove around, and it says, well, you can go to Marissa. Is that the name of the place? It's way out there, like a 3-mile, 3-hour drive. And my wife says, well, honey, this looks like ash coming at us. And we were there. And we turned and we went around and we got on the highway to go up towards Gold Beach, and we saw a guy loading water into a tanker truck. And I asked him if it was safe to go that way. He says, yeah. He says, but when you get to milepost 12, you turn left and not right, because you'll go into the fire if you turn to the right. The point I'm trying to make is I was there at that fire, and I saw the huge crews lined up, and you know, of course, they are all the way down steep hills, really difficult terrain. But the thing that bothered me the most was, is once I got beyond that fire, guess where I drove into? The old biscuit fire. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, what an absolute travesty we have going on here, that our forests burn up and we don't do anything about it. And it goes back to what Senator Hensel said about the fuel load. We need to start taking care of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, our whole state's going to just keep burning up, and all these forest industries, I mean, are we going to go cut those trees? Probably not. They're not going to let us salvage anything as they did in biscuit. It's just a travesty. And I can, you know, as Senator Hensel said, you can't control the fire, you can't control the lightning or the dryness of it, but you can certainly go in and manage these forests, thin them out so that the fuel load is spread out a little bit, and Senator Hensel will be able to talk to this much better than I, but if those trees aren't packed in like they are, holy smokers.
Senator Bercher, so there wasn't a question there. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I just had to tell my story. Okay. I think the department did a great job of summarizing what happened this summer, but I don't think they give themselves enough credit. The event we had at the end of July with a dry lightning storm, that was, I can never recall a lightning storm that dry, and especially following a week of 100-degree temperatures, so the fuel moistures was drier than your firewood, okay? It was dry. And we had a tremendous amount of starts. And they were active starts. Usually when we get a lightning storm, we get some higher humidities or we get a little rain or something, so we don't have real active fire behavior. But we had active fire behavior on 80-some fires right out of the gate. And to only have a few fires that actually amounted to something. They amounted to something. We're going to remember them. But I think we ought to also remember all the fires we don't remember. Mm-hmm. It could have been big fires. It could have been a lot worse than it was. And that was because of the department's quick action. And let me tell you something. You just don't drive to those fires. Somebody's got to walk to every single one of those in that country. And Southern Oregon and Northern California is the toughest country to fight fire in this country. So you guys need a lot of credit for that. A lot of fires got put out that morning.
Thank you for your hard work. And we're also fortunate we didn't have a situation like in Colorado Springs where we had obviously a lot more loss of property and life than we saw here. And Colorado is continuing to deal with some tough issues right now. But so as far as you'll be going to the e-board, it sounds like, to cover those additional costs. That's what I heard.
We will be in November. Yep. We'll be back there. And then this will be, and then I think statutorily we'll sort this out in February session. Tomorrow we're with House Ag, and then we're also before the Ways and Means Committee and then full Ways and Means on Wednesday.
Yeah, so you'll be, I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again. And and tomorrow we have a Ways and Means, so I'm assuming at some point you'll come to the Ways and Means Committee and give an update as well.
Yeah, we'll be there. We'll be there on Wednesday. You know, I think if you think about the workload, appreciate your comment. It really was peppered. The landscape was peppered with small starts. You look out across there and see little smokes coming up, and each one of those need attention. If you think about the work that folks did around the clock, sustaining the stamina and the adrenaline to be able to do that work. It's a slightly different type of work right now. Right now, our priority is paying the bills. And so when you think about the workload out there to fight the fire, we have an equal administrative workforce right now that's working to pay the bills from this record fire season. And that's a big load as well, to make sure that our contractors and cooperators get paid in a timely manner. We're working on that right now.
Well, thank you for your work. Thanks for being here today and providing us with an update.
You bet.
Thank you. And last but not least, and maybe this is a fact that we're going to hear from the Global Warming Commission, might be a good segue there, talking about weather and climate. We have a brief update from Andrew Durbin and Alan Salinka, both who are members of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. Thank you for your patience. Thanks for being here. And I guess you have one more presentation. Do you have a presentation? Okay.
Brief few slides.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Whoever wants to go first.
You're getting your money's worth today.
Yeah, we sure are. We have a lot to go. Well, you know, our committee covers a lot.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson. My name is Andrea Durbin, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Global Warming Commission. I'm also the Executive Director of Oregon Environmental Council. It's a pleasure to be with you here today. And today we are giving you a report on from the Global Warming Commission on the progress the state is making towards meeting the legislatively set greenhouse gas reduction goals. Just to recap, the Global Warming Commission was established in 2007 by House Bill 3543, and our charge is to recommend actions and assess our progress towards the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. The goals are set by the legislature. We have a list here of the commission members as well, and it's noteworthy to make sure you know that the report presented to you today, it comes reflecting the full consensus of this commission. So I'm going to walk you through the trends that we've seen in the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. In 1990, Oregon set a goal to establish to stabilize greenhouse gas reductions, but we had no strategy at that time. And as you'll see from this line, that the emissions were growing in the 90s and at about 1% a year and through 2000, and they were projected to continue growing. In 2004, Governor Kulongoski asked a Citizens Advisory Committee to come up with new goals and strategies to reduce the emissions. And the first goal that was set was to arrest the greenhouse gas reduction goals by 2020, so to stabilize the overall emissions by 2010. So between 2004 and 2010, the state and Oregon communities acted on many of these recommendations, adopted strategies, and you'll see that from this line that the emissions have flattened out. This is due in part to the strategies and policies that have been put in place. It's also partly due to the economic slowdown starting in 2008. But nevertheless, it is a real accomplishment and one that should be recognized. But the goal is not to just stabilize overall emissions. The goal is to reduce the emissions. The next goal that the legislature set was for 2020, and that is to reduce overall emissions by 10% from our 1990 levels. And we can predict today that what the how you can account for a number of the measures that are in place today and the impact it will have on our trends, projected trends over the next, between now and 2020. If you look at our energy efficiency commitments, there's a slight decline in resulting in emissions. If you factor in the renewable portfolio standard, which requires, as you've heard, large utilities to shift to new renewables, that reduces the overall emissions. If you factor in the agreement between the state and PGE to end its coal burning at the Boardman Power Plant by no later than 2020, that will also reduce overall emissions. And then in 2009, the legislature adopted expanding market access to cleaner fuels like electricity, propane, and compressed natural gas as a key strategy to reduce emissions as well. And that will also reduce emissions from the transportation sector. What's important to note there, however, is that the legislature must remove and lift the 2015 sunset date to achieve those emission reductions. So as you can see, if you factor in all those policy changes and policy adoptions, we are reducing overall emissions for the state, but we are not meeting yet on the way to meeting our 2020 targets to reduce emissions overall. So what it will require, as you see, where we're projecting where we need to go, the legislative set goal, requires both maintaining the existing policies I noted earlier, the RPS standard for new renewable energy, the Clean Fuels Program, energy efficiency programs, as well as adopting and implementing new programs to further reduce emissions. The difference in this delta between our current trend of where we're headed and where we need to go is about 19% in emission reductions. And where we really need to focus is the greatest source of emissions in our state, cars and coal.
Andrew, I need you to just move back from the microphone a little bit because it's hard to, I guess we're getting some feedback.
So if you look at our emissions sector, as you'll see here in the pie chart, the largest emission sectors come from our transportation sector, which represent 36% of Oregon's emissions. If you look next, it's electricity, which represents 31.5%. And of that, 45% of the energy we consume is coming from coal. And so those taken together are the two largest emission sectors. And then the smaller sectors are the residential and commercial activities, 12%, the industrial processes and other energy, 12%, and then the agricultural sector, about 8%. And with that, I'm going to turn to my colleague.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and Vice Chair Olson, Alan Zelenka, member of the Global Warming Commission. And thanks, Andrea. As Andrea was saying, 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from cars and coal. The good news about this is that we can get significant help from the federal government and the actions taken at the federal level to close that gap that we saw in the previous graph. The CAFE standards of increasing energy or MPG of cars and light trucks is going to increase significantly, and that will help us meet our goal dramatically. And also EPA power plant rulemaking about for new power plants will also help us meet our goal. It's these technology fixes that will help us get there. A good chunk and fill up a good chunk of that gap between where we are today and where we need to be on the road to the 2020 and the 2050 lines. On page 3 of the handout and on page 7 of the report, there's a page that has the scorecard that the commission has come up with. The commission has 40 actions from our 2012 roadmap that we created, and it's done by sector. And there are grades for each of these 40 actions from A to D, and A meaning that we're on track and D meanings that we're slipping behind. And you'll notice there are a few A's and few D's, but a lot of B's and a lot of C's. Overall, the commission gives our efforts so far at the state level about C+. And so that means we're gaining ground, but not fast enough. And in the next slide. So the 2012 roadmap had those six areas that are represented in that chart. Each one of them had a subcommittee that had and I chaired the transportation land use one as a co-chair. And each one of these subcommittees had a group of experts of 10 to 12 people that worked on developing these and brainstorming all the different actions that are possible in those particular sub areas. And then they narrowed those down to the priority action items. It's the 40 priority action items from all those different lists that come together for this report, the scorecard. And so the 12 for transportation and land use are here on this slide. And you can see that, again, we have from D plus to A, but a lot of B's and C's. Give you an example of kind of where we are. We've had some actions with significant progress and some not. On the significant progress, on the urban growth boundary footprints and compaction of that, we've kind of held the line for the last 20 years. Metro has done a significant job there. Eugene and Springfield is another area where there's going to be a little expansion of the urban growth boundary, but not significant. So that's one of the areas where we get an A. But adopting the low carbon fuel standard and getting rid of that sunset in 2015 was an area that where we didn't make much progress. So each sector has this kind of mixed bag of different actions and different grades.
So just to sum up today's presentation and, importantly, the report, we've made some progress, but we're not on target yet to meet the state's next emissions goals set by the legislature by 2020. The state, in order to do so, the state will need to maintain core programs that we've passed in place already, including the RPS, the Clean Fuels Program, our commitment to energy efficiency, and we will need to develop new programs and policies to reduce emissions even further to meet that the equivalent of about 19% of emissions levels from 2010. This includes making sure that the transition of the Boardman coal power plant by PGE prioritizes replacing that power with energy efficiency and conservation. It includes investing more in transit, bike, pedestrian, and car share models. And ultimately, it will include establishing an economy-wide signal, whether that's through a carbon cap and trade system, or a carbon tax, to institute real limits on carbon pollution. The good news is that some of the federal standards that are in place will contribute towards our progress and will help, but it will not fill that gap completely. We encourage this committee to evaluate and explore the new programs and policies that will reduce emissions further from the transportation sector and from the electricity sector, in particular focusing on cars and coal. And we appreciate having the opportunity to present the report and look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Just a quick question based on your handout here. You have the seven propositions on the last page. If looking at having, I'm assuming these would all go towards meeting the 19%, this is the last page of the handout there. If you had to prioritize, I mean, did the Global Warming Commission sort of prioritize or say these are all a range of options, where we'd get the biggest bang for buck if we were to adopt policies? Or expand, you know, some of them are already in place, it might be expanding policies.
Chair Dingfelder, the Global Warming Commission, as Alan noted, has made recommendations in the roadmap, clustering those recommendations representing 40 different sectoral changes, and these represent some of those recommendations. The work that really still needs to be done is looking at the gap, that delta, that needs to be filled yet, and which are the policies and programs that would most effectively further reduce the emissions.
Senator Dingfelder, I would add that there is no one thing that is going to fill that gap. Mm-hmm. There is no silver bullet. As Bill McKibben said, this is the answer to this dilemma is silver buckshot instead. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of little or modest things that we can do that add up to a significant impact, and that's why there are 40 of these actions that we have on our list. And so all of them end up being significant when in total, but none of them in each by themselves necessarily. Some have bigger impacts than others. Like, for instance, the least low carbon fuel standard had a pretty large impact in terms of a single particular issue or particular action. But I don't know that I would. I think it's something we have to do comprehensively as opposed to pick and choose one or the other.
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, on this, from the state perspective, our resources are somewhat limited, and if we have to choose out of 40, we have to decide where we're going to put our energies and prioritizing. And if you had recommendations, sounds like the low carbon fuel standard, one of those, and continuing on the RPFs, obviously, we just had a presentation on that, making sure we continue to implement.
That's right. But Chair Dingfield, remember that both of those programs are kind of assuming putting us on the trajectory to reduce already, but they don't necessarily deal with that gap that still remains. And so really focusing on shifting the way our dependence from coal-fired power plants, energy that's supplying energy demand, energy consumption in the state of Oregon, as well as really looking at new ways to fund transportation and channel funding into transit and pedestrian and bike options is also a big priority.
And Chair Dingfelder, to answer your question more directly, the biggest bang for your buck in the state of Oregon is energy efficiency. And that is not only the cheapest, most cost-effective, but it also lowers people's operating cost of their houses and their businesses and makes them more more effective and more efficient and makes their bottom line better. So that's where I would stick most of my emphasis if moving forward.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? There are the presenters. Great. Thank you very much. We will make sure that everybody gets the full copy of the report as I see it's here, but Beth will send out the link so folks can have it. And appreciate you being here. I know it's been a long hearing, so I know. But there's been themes throughout this with the RPS and talking about impacts of fire, talk about carbon, impact of carbon, and ways that we can reduce the carbon loading for our environment. And be looking forward to reading the report.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you
all.
And with that, Beth, any business we need to do? Anything else, Shelley, for the good of the order? Okay. With that, then, our informational meeting is adjourned. Thank you for your patience. Thank you.